everyone, and welcome to Between the Sheets, episode 14. And tonight we're talking about the week of October 20th through the 26th of 1990. And it's our second time in 1990, but been a while since we've been there, so we got a little freshness going on. And tonight, of course, I'm joined by my guest host, co-host, David Vix is fan. Vix, what's going on?
I'm doing well. I'm trying to figure out how to use my new microphone, as some people complained about.
Yes, you you had that little soft-spoken thing going on the previous show, whenever you actually had a chance to speak. But, you gotta sometimes adapt and roll with the punches. But
I have to point in a completely different direction.
That's so as long as you speak into that tip, we'll be all right.
Yes, it's still Skype, so we're still talking over each other. So,
of course, that's going to happen. But at least we're not on talk show anymore. So that's one good thing. And our guest tonight is a first time guest, and somebody who people asked me when I first started doing shows, when are you going to do some shows with this guy? Because they want to hear us on the show together because they think we sound so much alike. And the main reason is because we're both from the state of Georgia, the Peach State of Georgia, although he's from the Newnan area on the west side, and I'm from Barnesville in the South Metro Atlanta area. But you know him from Where the Big Boys Play on this Place to Be Nation Network. That is Chad Campbell. Chad, how's it going?
Going good, Chris. Yeah, I think it's just Georgia racism. That's all I can chalk it up to.
And Chad's one of the few people in the online that has actually met me in real life. So he's on a list of Wes Hatch, Phil Schneider, Tom Carroll Gassner, and our good buddy, the Frey Movement, who just got owned by Johnny Gargano on the Voice of Wrestling Forum yesterday. Yeah. So go be on the lookout for that one.
You know, he still has me blocked after the NXT thing.
Well, that's a whole nother story. In fact, before this show's over with, I'm going to give you a chance to talk about that a little bit, because there's a future Exile on Bass Street coming up that kind of mentions that. Anyway, let's get back.
You recorded that already.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we'll let you rebut. But back to the matters at hand. We are, of course, in October 20th to 26th, 1990. And we're going to start the show with the World Wrestling Federation, since we actually ended up with them on the last show. So it worked out fine. And they're going through some interesting times here, as this is kind of like the beginning of the end of the glory era of the Hogan era in a lot of ways. Warriors, heavyweight champion. These guys are starting to get older. You're starting to see some newer guys starting to get better positioning. And on that front, the promotion is planning on dropping some of their mid-card to lower-card wrestlers, as well as some of the front office personnel over the next few weeks as a form of cutting costs. They decided to cut the number of squads on the road from 3 to 2. And there were quite a few people in the promotion panicking over the moves, but it was subsided as the week went on, as they found out that there are no real key people would be cut. This cost cutting is coming at a time where the promotion is focusing on creating a bodybuilding brand, as well as the building of a new $9 million office complex. House show profits have been down a good bit lately, but Hulk Hogan will be working more dates soon, so they expect that number to rise. Now, supposedly, Honky Tonk Man, who is one of the names on the chopping block, is staying. He's staying around a $600 a week clip to be an announcer. And Bill Eady, of course, Demolition Axe, has decided to stay on board in a front office job. Now, Bix, there was quite a few names, big names on that list. And the thing is, though, that some of those names, they like disappeared for a couple of weeks, but came back. So maybe they took lesser deals, but talk about some of the other names that was, bandied around.
Well, I mean, I'm thinking about, as far as the guys you mentioned here, I mean, and plus, Jim Neidhart was another big one. None of them really, none of it went the way anyone expected. Because Neidhart was going to be maybe fired, maybe switched to an announcer, and that did end up happening a little bit later. But he didn't end up getting fired, so when they realized he wasn't leaving. They didn't air the Rockers Heart Foundation title change. Honky Tonk Man stuck around a little longer, right? And he became an announcer, but not for long.
He was replaced by Savage.
Right, and also I think he turned down the $600 a week.
One of them said he did. Yeah, one of them said he turned it down. The other one said he took it.
Okay, it was Matt Walsh that said he turned it down, right?
Yeah, but of course he eventually stayed.
And maybe it was more than $600 a week then. And
maybe.
It was the other one. And now Bill Eadie, he did leave after Survivor Series, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so that, but he didn't take the office job.
He had the job, and I guess they took it away from him or whatever because he was wanting to go to Japan to a tour, and they got all upset about that, and that's what led to basically, you know, I guess them rescinding his job offer, and then of course the lawsuit happened. But you know, some other guys, like I was saying, Jimmy Snuka was on this list. Greg the Hammer Valentine was on this list. Coco Beware was on this list. The Genius, Lanny Poffo, was on this list, which pissed Savage off, of course. Am I missing anybody, Biggs?
I mean, those sound like the key ones. And like you said,
Black Bart, Pez Watley, Jim Powers, guys like that, you know, were all on the list.
The touring job guys.
Yeah, the touring job guys. So, I mean, yeah. You could see why they were doing what they were doing, but still, you're building this brand new $9 million office complex, and you're, I guess, trying to put the money back for the WBF, which, cheap plug, go check out Bix's article about the WBF and Fighting Spirit magazine.
Current issue.
But it's just interesting. Now, Chad...
I just realized the new... Because of the way that the calendar worked out this month, it's not going to be the current issue anymore a few days after the show comes out.
Well, it's still up there. Yes. But anyway,
Triple H NXT cover, that issue.
Yeah. But yeah, Chad, this is, like I said, the end of an era in ways where some of these older names are getting cut. WWF started a different type of movement in 1991. Your opinions, do you think that this was just change was needed? And they had to freshen up, or do you think that some of these guys may have got a raw deal?
Well, I mean, I think it's kind of a traditional thing that the fall in the WWF is, I guess, historically not the most interesting time for the promotion in general. But when I went through the yearbook stuff for 1990, the fall of 1990 in particular in the WWF was just really dreadful. I thought the build to Survivor Series with Demolition versus Ultimate Warrior felt very mid-card, and that was kind of presented as the main event. And then you had Hogan kind of coming back and a holdover for that, and they were talking a little bit about the Ultimate Survival, but it did feel like a change was needed. Now as we get into 91, we see what the changes were in the early going with Slaughter. They were gearing up for that, but it definitely felt like, as far as some of the older, more established stars, they were kind of at the end of their rope within the promotion of the WWF, and kind of a new era of stars were needed to be transitioned in.
And one thing I noticed is that most of the guys we talked about, at least as far as more of the name guys, even if they did end up sticking around, they either were gone in 91... or they were the guys who ended up being allowed to take outside bookings when,
as we talked about before.
Yeah, as we talked about in 91. Right. So right. Valentine, Coco, Poffo being the key ones.
Yeah, and you know, as Chad mentioned about Survivor Series and stuff like that, it was real weird at the time thinking about the main program on the show was featuring a bunch of guys with painted faces. Was the Warrior and the LOD and Demolition. You know, that was just like a interesting deal for WWF. And
well, that wasn't the interesting part. The interesting part was that you had the Ultimate Warrior, the Road Warriors, and the Modern Day Warrior, although only Ultimate Warrior by that name, as the Warriors.
Yeah. Yeah, even though Kerry Von Erich wasn't, you know, touted as the modern day warriors of Texas Tornado, but
the Legion of Doom wasn't called the Road Warriors.
Yeah, and it just didn't have that big main angle going on at the time because Hogan was still doing stuff with Earthquake, and Warrior was still doing stuff. Like I said, with he's working with Demolition. His, you know, Rude had just quit, you know, a couple weeks before this.
Well, technically, it was Mr. Perfect that he was feuding with.
Technically, yeah, but you wouldn't have known.
on the house shows, it was all him and Road Warriors against Demolition, right?
Yeah, you wouldn't have really known that. You wouldn't have really known that Warrior and Perfect had something going on. Maybe if you saw the television, it was hinted at, but and they maybe shot angles for it, but it wasn't treated as a big deal. And I think maybe the hottest angle in the promotion was Dusty against DiBiase. That just about gets started up. So, I mean.
Yeah, because the Saturday night's main event is kind of right when that really kicks off into gear with Dustin at ringside. So,
yeah, it's just an interesting time in WWE. And
well, also, since this is, you know, makeover, reduced paint, Kerry Von Erich hair warrior, is this around when they had the Amanda Ultimate Warrior thing? Or was that earlier in the year?
I really don't know.
I know a way I can find out. So good, talk, and I'll look.
All right. Meanwhile, all the unrest is going on in Stamford, Connecticut. Vince McMahon's right-hand man, Dick Glover, J.J. Dillon, and Akio Sato were in Japan meeting with All Japan, New Japan, and Super World Sports about working out a deal where the WWF would be part of a Tokyo Dome show in the spring of 1991. Hachiro Tanaka's SWS looks like the favorite because Tanaka really wants to work with the WWF and would give them the most favorable deal because he would allow the WWF to pretty much call all of the shots, which is something that All Japan and New Japan would be reluctant to do. Talk is that the WWF would rather work with New Japan because they feel like they're the most established promotion in the country, with a shot there to Baba, and with the biggest following, but they know it would be easier to work with SWS. WWF not only wants a dome show, but they want a promotion where they can send talent to tour, and the WWF would get paid by the promotion for their talent, which is different from the past, where the Japanese promotion would pay the talent themselves and the promotion a flat booking fee. Now, regarding New Japan, there is talk that hardly anyone there wants to work with the WWF because they know what would happen in those matches. If such a show happens, the WWF is looking to get $750,000 off the top of the gate to cover travel expenses and other expenses. And then the remainder of the gate would be split 50-50. Now, as an example of that, the New Japan Tokyo Dome show from 1989 had a gate of $2.1 million, which doesn't leave much for whatever Japanese promotion to work with at that price. The All Japan meeting was said to be completely out of courtesy, and that Giant Baba didn't even attend the meeting, as there's still some heat there from their dealings earlier in the year. All right. Bix, talk about the real quick. Talk about the heat between All Japan and WWF from earlier in the year.
Well, they worked together on the U.S. Japan Wrestling Summit card at the Dome, which New Japan was technically also involved in, but they only did their own matches. They didn't do interpromotional matches with the other two. And Baba and Vince disagreed on everything. So they just kind of, when they could, they just alternated philosophies each match, like as far as who would be doing the ring announcing and if there would be calls for the time expired and time remaining. Those they just alternated. But then Baba wanted the ring to be dead center in the dome like it had been so far for the other wrestling shows and like it would be later on traditionally. Vince wanted the ring in the infield, as was done generally with American baseball stadium shows, with the idea being that it would look better on camera if they didn't sell it out. And I'm trying to remember how well that show did it, but it wasn't a sellout, right?
I think it did 50-some thousand.
Billed as 50-something thousand, which in the dome back then probably means 35.
Maybe, and this is in the dome is 60-some thousand. I think 67,000 capacity.
No. That's the work capacity.
Oh, well.
No, that's what I'm saying. Legit capacity was something like 55.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cage Match has it announced at 44,000.
Okay, so that's far from a sellout.
So yes. Vince wanted, no matter which way you look at it.
Right. Vince wanted in the infield with the idea being it would look better on camera. And Bubba's like, no, because then the fans won't have as good views if they're in the outfield. So I'm trying to remember. Is it dead center? Or is it because it
looks it's dead center.
Dome shows, though.
It's in the center, but I think it was recorded differently than what we saw on Coliseum Video.
It was definitely shot differently from the other dome shows.
Yes.
So, and I know there's other stuff too. There's the
Ultimate Warrior versus Ted DiBiase was
right. So Hogan. It was originally going to be Hogan Stan Hansen as the main event. It was originally going to be Hogan Terry Gordy.
Yeah.
Hansen convinced Gordy not to lose to Hogan. And Gordy originally had been okay with losing to Hogan because Hogan was going to be the champion. And Vince did not tell Bob that Hogan was going to lose the title to Warrior. So they set this up kind of double-crossing Bob because he was okay with having one of his guys lose to Hogan's champion like that, top guy. So then Stanson maneuvers it so that he's the guy saving the show and blah, blah, blah. But that's not really relevant to the heat, the Hansen part, just that Vince kind of double-crossed Bob on that. I'm sure there's more, but those are the big ones.
Yeah, Bob was upset with the matchups, and it was just a big clusterfuck. So, I mean, like I said, that deal was out of courtesy. Of course, New Japan, they had the history with, going back to the 80s, and that it made sense for them to work together, but the New Japan guys, I guess seeing what happened on the last show with All Japan, they didn't want any part of that. We'll talk about New Japan in a minute, but SWS was the perfect promotion to work with, Chad. I mean, they're just now brand new. They're wanting to do whatever they can to make a name for themselves. So what better to do than to, bring in Hulk Hogan and the stars of WWF?
Yeah, that was kind of when you were reading through that. I mean, to me, like, the demands of WWF just in that story is preposterous overall. But, SWF's really, from, I guess, a relationship standpoint for both companies at that point in time, with WWF still wanting to have a presence in Japan and start company looking to have a partner in WWF. And I would say from maybe a viewership standpoint with what we saw in 1991, it was a really kind of cool partnership for a while with the 10 room matches and the LOD, that tag match and all that. So I kind of enjoyed, I guess, their short union that they had with each other throughout 1991.
Even other weird stuff like Rick Martel versus Naoki Sano, or
right
things like that, and also of course they had all that money to spare.
Yeah, because Hiroshi Tanaka was just filthy rich.
So, but, you know, I mean, does anybody were they doing the? Did SWS kind of agree with that deal then that they would pay? They wouldn't just pay the talent themselves; so they would actually pay the WWF for the talent.
I really don't know. I didn't try to, go real deep in the following up about that, right. That the particulars of the deal. But they obviously did something because they worked together for a good bit. And then, once SWS died, WF worked with War, so they stayed with Tenru. So, they had a relationship with Tenru for a good 3-4 years.
Well, it was weird though. They didn't send talent for most of the time, though. I guess Haku, I don't think he was under contract, though, most of that time, but he kind of ended up in War a little. But, really, aside from the first few shows where Flair went in and then the stuff in 95 where they sent 1-2-3 Kid and Yokozuna, did they really work to... Oh, Owen Hart. That's right.
Well, Savage went over, and, they had all the guy Undertaker.
Did Savage go to War? I thought he just had the SWS match with Tenryu.
I know they had shows. Yeah. They had shows that were handhelds. They're around. I don't know if that was War, SWS.
Well, you know what? I'm sure there's more shows we don't know about and stuff, or really aren't familiar with that, like, aren't as big shows, because until they released that Ultimo Dragon DVD, I had no idea that Owen Hart ever worked War.
And I think those Japan shows may have been WWF shows in Japan, but with, you know, help from...
Oh, this was an SW... The one I'm talking about with Owen Hart, that's an SWS show.
I know, but I'm talking about after the fact.
Oh, the 94 stuff, you mean?
Yes.
Did they use War Guys on that? I'm trying to remember. Did Tenru... Tenru was on that tour, right?
Yes.
But I'm trying to remember who else, because they used Mishinoka Pro Guys, they used Tenru... I'm trying to remember what other locals they used. Was Bull Nakano on that tour?
I think so, because she was around. Yeah, they went in May. They went May of 94. Mm-hmm. And you had Shinzaki. You had Nobukazu Harai.
So that's another
Bull Nakano. Masashi Aoyagi was on those shows. We had a match.
His official was it? He would have still been with New Japan or
Saki Hasegawa was on those shows.
So wait, where was Aoyagi at that? Who was he with at that? Was it War? Or was it?
Yeah, he was with War.
Okay.
Yeah. Listen.
Okay. Yeah, you have a few War.
Kyoko Inoue. And they were bringing all different kind of different Joshi wrestlers to work against Alundra Blaze.
So it was War, All Japan Women, and Mishinoka Pro.
Yeah,
but this is the show where, like, I mean, I've seen the Bret Hart versus Savage match from Japan. That's this.
Yeah, okay. And Savage wore teal. That was in Yokohama.
Right. Okay.
Which the semi-main event of that show was Undertaker and Tenru over Yokozuna and Bam Bam Bigelow. What a match!
That sounds like it could be really good under the right.
Yeah, I know. That's the thing with these matches. I mean, that's why I love that SWS stuff, because. I mean, I don't think any of it, you know, is some 5-star classic, but it feels like kind of as a kid when you would dump out all your wrestling figures and mishmash all these people together, and that's kind of the type of tag matches we would get on some of these shows.
Also, people forget about it especially because of the finish, because in the first match and then the Chuck Norris stuff in the second one, Undertaker and Yokozuna actually had good matches.
Oh, totally. But listen to this craziness. They ran a double shot on May the 12th. I know we're getting way off base here. They ran a double shot on May the 12th where they ran Guam and then went and ran Honolulu.
With the same crew?
With the same crew. So they went across the time zones. Basically, they went back to the future. That's what a crazy double shot. Guam and Hawaii. Wow. But anyway, back to the matters at hand. New Japan, though, does want to have a Tokyo Dome show in that time period. And they already have clearance from TBSI for a 2-hour primetime time slot, but they would rather work with WCW instead of the WWF because they think that they would be easier to work with and would give them more of a favorable deal. Plus, they have better wrestling talent than the WWF does. It was rumored that New Japan was upset that the talent that the WWF had offered to come over was the Bushwhackers and other talent of their ilk. Could you imagine, like, them sending in the Bushwhackers, Power and Glory.
Nikolai Volk.
Although I like Power.
Yeah.
And I like Power and Glory. Yeah. But the Warlord, guys like that over there to work against, Hashimoto, Chono, and Muto. I think New Japan made the right move, Bix. And it worked out tremendously for them, the align with WCW.
Yeah, I'm just trying to, in my head, to think about, the Warlord versus Tony Halma, boxer versus wrestler.
Which we'll talk about later on the show.
I know.
Tony Halma.
Yeah, could you imagine? That's the type of thing. Bushwhacker, who would the Bushwhackers face? Let's think of it. Who are the tag teams in New Japan?
That would have been Hase and Sasaki.
Yeah, that would
Sasaki,
probably.
And who was Koshinaka teaming with in 1990?
Oh God!
I'm trying to think who were the tag teams then, and I can't remember.
Well, the Blood Outlaws were around then.
Oh,
so that'd be like Goto and Saito or something like that.
Goto and Saito as the Blood Outlaws against the Sheepherders actually sounds like it would be fun if they were the Sheepherders, doesn't it?
Yeah. But, well, imagine who would be a good like junior type guy go over there.
I'd probably just throw over the Genius and he could
the Genius versus Jushin Thunder Liger
or Martel again.
Yeah, so that just would have been interesting, but Chad, I know you watched all the New Japan WCW stuff, especially like that the first Dome show.
Which is what this show ended up being.
Which is what this show ended up being.
It was the day of spring 1991.
Exactly. That was a hell of a damn show. And WWF would have never been able to do a show like that with New Japan.
No, not that type of show. I mean, that was a deep show. Felt like a really solid show, like the top, I think, four or five matches deep. Then also had the Liger match underneath with Akira Nogami. And, I think certainly New Japan made the right choice, although they did end up getting El Gigante. So, the Bushwhackers may not be too bad by comparison.
But they also got Tatsumi Fujinami to win the World Heavyweight title.
That's true.
Ain't no way in hell that Vince McMahon was going to drop his champion in Japan. But, Bix, isn't it interesting, though, that how many of these shows have we done that – there's a topic of conversation about WWF wanting to run Japan.
A lot.
Why do you think that Vince McMahon was so obsessed with running in Japan?
If I had to guess, because A, it's a strong wrestling market that he gets to try to take over, if it's on his own or whatever. But B, he got so many of his basic promotional ideas from them as far as merchandise and stuff like that. That maybe he kind of wanted to prove he was doing that stuff better than New Japan was.
Yeah, I could see that.
Or something like that.
But it's interesting that we have different themes in running this show. And, we've already hit on Bam Bam Bigelow already once on this show. New Japan, WWF running Japan has become one of our new top themes. It doesn't matter if it's 1986. 1994, whatever. 1984, they want a presence in Japan. So, and eventually they would get it in a way, but, and ran their own shows there and taped television there. But, it's just a whole totally interesting deal. All right, back to the state side. Ed Leslie, of course, Brutus Beefcake, is telling people that he is planning on returning to wrestling in early 1991. But if he returned, he would have to wear a special mask over his face, which may mean a new gimmick for him. Leslie, in this recovery time from his surgery, had gotten his hair done almost exactly like Hulk Hogan. Wow. And has grown the facial hair to match, as he has done some stunt work for Hogan's movie Suburban Commando.
So wait, are you saying he was Hogan's stuntman in Suburban Commando?
That's what it said, that he was doing stunt work for him. Now, Bix, this is a theme that... not on this show, but in real life that was going on for many years. Why was Ed Leslie trying to be like Terry Bollea so much?
I don't know. I was watching a couple weeks ago one of those Dizzy Hogan promos from Portland.
Yes.
Hulk Hogan's brother, Dizzy Hogan, with the Farrah hair and the not the Hogan mustache, but just the creepy mustache.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Were you asking me that question expecting a specific answer?
I was just expecting some type of answer. It was like a theme. It was a theme early on, whether it was using a form of the name, whether it was Eddie Boulder, Dizzy Hogan, Eddie Hogan. But the only time that he really didn't have a Hogan ripoff gimmick was when he was Brutus Beefcake. In the first run. Before he got hurt.
Or that his gimmick wasn't built around being in Hogan's orbit. Is that correct?
Yeah.
I mean,
he
was Hogan's brother, or he was the disciple, he was the butcher.
He was a Hogan's cousin.
Right.
In the early days, everywhere he went, he was some form of deal with Hogan. I mean, why? Why do you think that?
Because they were friends and Hogan was a star and he felt it would help him, I guess.
But it really didn't.
It didn't. No, I mean, he wasn't. I asked you about this. What were we talking about this for? Like, a couple months ago, I was trying to figure out where Brutus, where he worked before he showed up in WWF. He was actually working anywhere. And it didn't seem like he was. Like, it seemed like he had a year where, other than a New Japan tour or two, he wasn't wrestling.
He worked Japan mainly. The last territory that I think he worked was working for Southeastern, where he was Ken Lucas's tag partner in '83.
He didn't show up in WWF till late '84, right?
No, it was early summer.
Yeah, or I mean, but still, you know,
but he was working New Japan. He worked like the I think the tag league in December. Right,
but, but as far as we could tell, he didn't
Europe.
Pay full
he worked time. Europe. Yeah, he worked for Autobahns
the whole time, though.
Well, he was going for long tours, and I'm pretty sure he brought. And a lot of those guys went into going to South Africa and
okay,
stuff.
Okay, so it's probably just stuff we don't have results from.
Exactly.
Okay, but
it's just weird.
But regardless, you're right though. It never helped him. Like in Portland, it's not like he was some big heel because he was. Well, that's what was weird too. Was that when he was heel at Dizzy Hogan? It was when Hogan was a babyface in Minneapolis too.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
The whole thing, like, I didn't realize that when I watched it. It's like, oh, it's he's going to be, you know, shiny, happy babyface. They're talking about his brother, Hulk Hogan. And then he's like, no, shut up, all you stupid people in Portland.
And I guess you...
And he said about his disjointed, as I just said it.
Yeah, he was terrible on promos. But, you know, Chad, when he did come back, he, of course, never came back wearing a mask until later on when he actually did wrestle in 93. But he came back hosting the barbershop.
Oh, wait, though.
He seconded Hogan.
The Mariner thing was with a mask, though.
Yeah, but
that was in 91.
Yeah, but that really... Did I even make television?
Yes.
Okay.
Once
I don't
or
remember.
Twice, but a few of them didn't air.
Yeah. So they did actually... They did try that.
And they did have the other protective mask later, but that was really just a gimmick anyway. I mean...
Yeah. So they did actually do try. I totally forgot about the Mariner gimmick. I'm glad you brought that up. But you know he did he in Survivor Series. He remember he showed up there, you know, helping Hogan out as his second. Wasn't it Survivor Series? I know it was a show around that time period that he showed up.
I don't remember.
That's Hogan's backup. It may be a Saturday Night's Main Event or something.
I think it's Saturday Night's Main Event.
Okay, but he showed up, you know, and he had this huge mullet where you could tell where he had his hair long in the back and the hair on top was growing back in. So that may have been where the Hogan haircut came from Suburban Commando. But, yeah, he never really was the same after that wreck, you know, but he kept getting work because he's Hogan's friend. What do you think about Ed Leslie's career post, boating accident?
Rough. I mean, I don't think you can say. I mean, Barbershop was, I thought, a decent avenue for him, which is really odd because he really was not a good promo. But if he is going to still be within the WWF universe, then it wasn't a bad place for him with Brother Love winding down and kind of course, this predated the funeral parlor firing up. So it wasn't terrible where he could just go out there on the barbershop, say a couple of lines, and then throw to whoever he was interviewing. But once he decided then to make the full comeback in the ring from 93 to whenever up to the Disciple, I think, you know, it just... I mean, him being linked with Hogan, it always just gives the perception that he's just Hogan's lackey and that he's in a spot that he doesn't deserve based on who he's friends with, which I think is probably justifiable watching the footage, but he kind of, I don't know. I mean, in the Booty Man, I've actually watched some Booty Man stuff, and that may actually be the worst. Even Main Event Starrcade 94, I don't know if is as offensive as the Booty Man is to me, because it is just awful.
Now, I like the Zodiac. Yes, no, yes, no. I thought that was a great campy little gimmick, but Booty Man was terrible. But real quick before we move on, Vix, so how about the falling out between Ed Leslie and Hulk Hogan that happened a few years ago?
Did we find... Oh, no, yeah, right, because it was... didn't Leslie steal stuff from his house?
Yes. And these guys were like brothers forever, you know, no pun intended. I mean, they really were like brothers. And then he stole from Hulk Hogan.
It's really surprising from a guy who got fired from a toll booth job because there were an evacuation was called because they thought his cocaine was anthrax.
Yes.
I still can't believe that's a real story. Like in my head, it's like, no, wait, that was a joke someone came up with that people believed, right?
And I think, like, so.
No, but that was real, wasn't it?
Yeah. I think it was a joke, but then it was proven it was real. Everybody thought it was a joke.
That's what I'm saying, yeah. That like every yeah. like it was like – wasn't it like maybe – it must have been like a prolonged period where it was like a day or two where people thought it was a joke. It was one of those things like – it was probably when not every like TV station or whatever had a website or would put all the news on the website right away. So it was like reported locally in Boston or something. And well, it was also like, wait, why is he in Boston? You know, that type of thing. So
yeah.
But yeah, that's not really surprising. And then there was the thing recently where – he was selling photos that he said were signed by Hogan, which
yeah, what a train wreck it was. But moving on.
He and Virgil should
go into Well, Virgil's a very sane man compared to Ed Leslie, I think. But anyway, moving on. Virgil's getting that fuck money. Ed Leslie ain't. Bobby the Brain Heenan, who actually negotiated with Jim Herd about coming in as an announcer for WCW, decided to stay with the WWF and basically use Herd as leverage to get a much better contract from the WWF. Now, Heenan's contract was to expire in February, but meanwhile, Jake the Snake Roberts turned his notice in 2 weeks ago and decided to stay at the last minute and will return to work on November 17th. Now, Roberts had been upset with Vince McMahon over how his character had been portrayed and the fact that Vince no longer wanted Jake to use Damien. Both sides eventually came to an agreement to use Damien on a limited basis. Now, Chad, I know you've watched a lot of WCW, NWA from that time period. Of course, Bobby Heenan would eventually come in as an announcer in 94. But how do you think the television would have been with Bobby Heenan there in 1991 working with Jim Ross?
This is kind of one of my actual favorite what ifs from the year as a whole. And I remember I guess leading into the Halloween Havoc 90 stuff when Parv read out this story, because it seems very fascinating, especially with what we know is going to happen with Jim Cornette's departure. And you know, at that time Cornette did have the Midnight Express, but he was also doing his Louisville Slugger interview segment a lot. Was kind of an overall, I would say, kind of more personality for the program than just a manager per se. So if Ross would have slotted it in right there with Heenan coming in, I think that could have been very fun to watch around this time, especially you could have even had some very interesting things with like somebody like Paulie, where Paulie and Heenan are, you know, friends, but then what ended up happening with Cornette and Paulie, where there's kind of always that underlining feud a little bit between the two, and they would jab back and forth. And I just think it would be tremendously entertaining, because really, I mean, Heenan, and when he does come in with announcing, I mean, it's obvious as he gets later on into the Nitro era, he's just over it and there. But even before that, I think by 94, the light was kind of flickering as far as his, I guess, overall passion or desire to be in the wrestling business. So coming in, this would be almost three years earlier, would have been, I think, really interesting. And I can't imagine he would work. I mean, I'm not someone that likes the Jesse and Ross team announced.
Neither of them.
Right. I agree that you could kind of feel that animosity on air. So it's not one of my favorite teams. So I think Ross and Heenan would have worked better together and had more chemistry.
Yeah, but Bix, this changes WWF if this happens, because Heenan, of course, would become the number one, you know, announcer, the color man on the big shows in 91. He, you know, stepped away from managing.
Although they never put him on Superstars, though.
They never put him on Superstars, but him and Gorilla, though. Well, of course, Superstars was Vince and his band, the Merry Men, but the pay-per-views were always Gorilla and Bobby Heenan, you know, for a good couple of years there. And that's where we get the magic between those two. What do you think happens if, you know, Heenan's not there? Is Gorilla and Piper for big shows? I mean, it gets pretty rough to think about what could have been.
I'm going to guess Gorilla and Piper, because they did use Piper as a third man in the booth on pay-per-views.
At times, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm just trying to think who else was there.
Lord Al. I mean, there's pretty...
Yeah, I mean, there's really, when it comes... for color, I mean, after... Because, I mean, who was it Piper yet on Superstars at this point? Or
at that point, yes, because he replaced Jesse.
Oh, right. He was Jesse's replacement. Then what was, and then what was
Vince, see, Vince Piper
and Honky Tonk Man? Or was it
everybody? Yeah, I was going to say, when was Honky in there? That was later on.
Yeah, he would be in like 91.
Okay.
But it was never just Vince, or was it ever just Vince and Honky Tonk Man?
No.
It was Vince Piper and Honky Tonk Man.
Unless Piper had that motorcycle accident, so it may have been Vince and Honky Tonk Man during that time period.
Okay.
And that was around WrestleMania.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Was there anyone else in that was a color guy? Or would they have had to bring someone in?
I think they would have had to bring somebody in or move somebody.
Or move another wrestler.
They could have put Henning in there. But it totally changes because Heenan was so key to the Ric Flair, you know, yep. angle. I mean, it's definitely a big what if. Now, Jake Roberts is another one picks that he, from what I read, there was no real, deep negotiations with WCW. But Jake Roberts, he had gotten pretty stale as a babyface. And he came back, you know, had the great deal with Martel and all that stuff, but how do you think he would have been in WCW if he would have made that jump?
Because it's not, right. I mean, as good as he was in '92, I mean, that's when his issues really started to could just completely take him over in terms of it affecting his work more. So I think he would have been good. So let's see. So this is late 1990. If we figure he's coming in early '91, I mean, you've got Sting. I'm trying to think of who else. Sting, Luger, still a babyface. You don't have Koloff, because I'm trying to think of who he worked with in 92 and who
he starts at Wrestle War, though, Koloff does.
As a heel, though.
Yes.
Trying to think. Steiner's. But I'm trying who's there that wasn't there when he was there later on?
What about Hansen?
Hansen's around.
I'm also thinking of it from the perspective that he comes in as a heel. If he comes in as a babyface,
that's the thing. That's the question. Do you bring him in as a face or do you bring him in as a heel, Chad? What do you think?
Yeah, that's interesting because, I think you would have to flesh out and see which side. Because even if he came in as a face, I mean, Jake the Snake, this is nostalgia, but Jake the Snake was my number two wrestler as a kid. And 91 is really, 90 and 91 is really when I really first started becoming a fan. And it was Hulk Hogan and Jake the Snake. And even as a five-year-old, I kind of realized in the confines of the WWF, is like, well, Jake doesn't seem to be winning as much as he probably should, given how popular he is. Now, of course, who knows with WCW if they could have done any better. They didn't have a great track record of that. But even him as a face, if he could have run a program with Flair, who I think certainly in 91 was stale. I mean, you had him winning the title back from Sting, and then until he pretty much bolts for WWF, he's not doing a whole lot, kind of messing with Fujinami, but that's... That's not a blood feud or anything, and that was pretty limited in the dates they wrestled and the way they promoted that. So, and then you would also have Hansen that you could have if he was coming in as a face.
How about a Jake and Arn feud for the TV title?
Right. I mean, so I actually think a face, and then you could transition him to a heel. And maybe it would have worked, or even Jake versus Cactus Jack when he was kind of starting to find his bearings. I think that could be. 91. I mean, the promo battles between them, I think, could have been great because Cactus Jack throughout 1990 and into 1991, that's really where he found his voice. I think they could have had some entertaining matches too, focused around psychology.
Or you could even do like Jake as Arn's counterpart as like the babyface TV champion.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So the possibilities are endless. I mean, I did crap on WWF TV before a little bit from around this time, but the Rick Martel angle, and I'm actually watching this right now, and the classic angle that aired the week we're talking about is when Jake comes out in that really awful gray sweater and ends up DDTing Brother Love on the set. But that's one of those things where it feels kind of hokey just hearing about it, where you know, Jake is blinded by the arrogance, but the seriousness that they presented that angle and the acting done really makes that probably my favorite thing going on at WWF at the time. Going back and rewatching it, it feels very complete as an angle and as a feud overall.
Well, also it has one of those extra WWF touches because, like, if you're in any other promotion, whether it's WCW at that time, even later. Is anyone else going to the point of having the detail where they get him the contact lenses so he can take the sunglasses off and make it
right.
Look like his eyes are rolling back and all that?
Yeah, yeah. I'm watching that as you were talking about it, Bix. And, I mean, that contact lens looks really gnarly. I mean, all you can see is just white after he DDTs Brother Love and he's kicking around and kind of gets restrained. It is. That's nasty.
Yeah, it's another. Yeah, definitely. What if? And with Jake, you know, if you turn him heel on WCW, I mean, the easiest way to do it is, you know, have him turn on Sting. Everybody else did, so Jake could have been the
might as well
guy on the list. And finishing up with WWF, and something that probably should be happening today, Titan Sports has got a new executive producer. Boy, would they sure need that right now. But in 1990, they signed up John Filippelli, who was a three-time Emmy Award winner, to become the new executive producer of all their TV shows. Filippelli comes from NBC, where he was nominated 23 times for Emmys due to his work on Super Bowls, World Series, and NBC Sports World. And John is expected to reshape the structure of the broadcast from the theme music to the special segments to everything, basically, because Vince McMahon thinks the TV ratings are too low. Filippelli is replacing Bruce Prichard, who is said to be completely upset with this decision, and has talked about leaving. This move is especially funny because Jim Crockett, who was still a minority owner in WCW's time, has been lobbying the brass at Turner about hiring a guy like Filippelli to be in charge of the NWA production instead of Jim Ross and Tony Schiavone. Yeah, Bix. I mean, this is something that they needed a fresh, you know, vision on production. And God knows they need it today. Oh, sweet Jesus, they need it today. But Filippelli, I don't know how long he lasted, but there was definitely a difference when he started. I think the themes changed, the graphics changed. I mean, there was a noticeable difference.
When did he start?
I think he started in early 91, maybe in the 90s.
So that would be, if we're trying to think superstars, that would be what, Ultimate Warrior's Laser Eyes opening?
Something like that. And that's when the logos changed around that time as well. Then that's when they went to the pink and black type logo for Superstars. The black banner.
Yeah.
That was around this time. Because it used to be the blue.
Oh, because, yeah.
Blue
yeah,
with the
right.
gold.
So this is right. This is when they finally changed it. Like, and they had like the same theme from the opening, but with the different colors on the Chiron. With the graphics
yes.
and all that. And Challenge. I'm trying to remember Challenge. And Challenge had this like kind of the same look for a while. Well, actually, I mean it did change, but in 90 the graphics looked really dated. We should probably
yes.
talk about this. Like they changed stuff up, but it didn't work. Because I mean that's when it was like everything was very blue, but very like old fashioned looking, like
yes.
fonts on the graphics and that type of thing. Like a lot of blue and orange and yellow.
It's kind of like. It was, yeah, and Bruce Prichard, I mean, it kind of had like a old school territory feel to it.
Which could be a Bruce Prichard thing.
Which yeah. is a Bruce Prichard thing.
They would end the segments with like the circle, you know, that closes in, like the Brother Love segments would, it wouldn't just be they would go to the next segment, they would have the black circle, that bubble that would kind of go up and then evaporate.
Actually, what was the color scheme on for... Houston Wrestling for the KHTV set. Wasn't it kind of like a blue and a gold?
Yes. Yes, it was.
There you go.
Yeah. There, exactly. For those of you that watch NWA Classics, the great service that Bruce Tharp's got out, the promo's on there. You're set behind Paul Bosch. It's definitely that blue color, that kind of a royal blue, baby blue. And the what's the TV station
KHTV.
In Houston? KHTV is in like a gold lettering.
And I just realized something else with what Chad was talking about. What wrestling show used more dissolves than any other wrestling show?
Houston Wrestling.
So
there you go. There's your answer. Now, on the flip side, Chad, the production on NWA/WCW was definitely kind of hokey in a lot of ways. And Jim Ross was in charge of the big shows, and Schiavone was in charge of the syndicated shows. They definitely did need some type of upgrade. So do you agree with Jim Crockett in that assessment?
Absolutely. It's really bad here. And one thing I wanted to touch real quickly was the primetime revamp. I don't know if he was kind of the catalyst for that.
Yes, forgot about that. Yeah,
I thought that was very important because that's a total reboot of that show.
Vince in his muscle suits.
Right. Yeah, the Zubaz going crazy.
Yeah,
the segments, but WCW around this point is just a disaster from a production standpoint to me, because it doesn't even look as official as the Memphis studio at all. I mean, you can watch the segments back to back that were on WCW Saturday Night and the Memphis Saturday Morning stuff. And I mean, to me, Dave Brown with his USWA microphone and the table there in the studio looks as good as this very generic, dark, danky-looking screen that they would use for a lot of Louisville Slugger segments and all sorts of other stuff. Really bad. And, of course, this was around the time, too, when they ventured out with the production where we got the kidnapping skit of Doom. So that was sort of WCW reaching into their production budget, and you can kind of get a glimpse of what they would produce with, I guess, some money and some brain power behind it, and not great. I mean, I kind of like that feud from a hokey standpoint, but I don't think it's a production masterpiece at all.
Well, and also with WCW, I mean, one of the things you'd really notice, besides all the things we always joke about with the production, because it happened throughout the company's whole life of shows being edited out of order, all that type of thing, one thing that was especially prevalent during this era was because they were overly relying on chroma keying guys in front of green screens to make it look like they were in an arena, in front of a set, whatever. And they always messed it up. Parts of guys' heads would get cut off. Like, do you remember what I'm talking about? Like,
yeah, it would.
Like, yes. The top of Bob Quartel's head would get cut off, or whatever,
or you could see a clear like line between this person that's supposed to be like a hard, kind of fuzzy wave line.
You could see an outline around everyone.
Just awful.
They did like a terrible job with that, and that, you know, they definitely did need their own voice. And I guess, should we talk about briefly, or does it go without saying? Because Chris was alluding to it as far as Kevin Dunn.
Yes, they. Like I said, I was alluding to it. WWE definitely needs an overhaul in production, because you go, and this is talked about on a future episode, Exile on Bad Street, that you could watch a Raw from 2004 and watch a Raw from 2015 and think it's the same show in a lot of ways, other than some of the talent being different.
Even like almost 97 when they went to the ramp. I mean, it's...
You go back that far. I mean, maybe some differences in Titantron and stuff like that, but it's just in bad need of new blood in production. No doubt. And
unfortunately, though, Vince thinks that Kevin Dunn is a production genius.
Yeah, well,
he probably is good at certain things with the vision of the show, but...
Well, they do great videos. You got to give them that, but...
Kevin Dunn time.
Yeah, but man, everything else is just a mess.
And Between the Sheets rolls on.
And we're going to roll right on to New Japan now, and... the Land of the Rising Sun, of course. And we'll talk about Tetsumi Fujinami, who made his official in-ring return. He did work a 5-minute exhibition match against Shiro Koshinaka on September 30th. But this is his official return from well over a year absence due to a severe back injury on October 25th at the Maebashi Green Dome in front of 10,800 fans in a 20,000-seat building, so a half house, as he teamed with Shiro Koshinaka to lose to Anamo Hamaguchi and Riki Choshu in their first match together as a team since 1986. Now, Choshu admitted before the match he was great friends with Fujinami, but it ended in the ring, and he would definitely work over his back, which he did, and went over Fujinami using a Saito suplex. Now, also on this show, we had an excellent match between Keiji Muto going over Hiroshi Hase. We had Masahiro Chono going over Kensuke Sasaki. Tiger Jeet Singh going over Big Van Vader by DQ. Shinya Hashimoto going over Larry Cameron. Bad News Allen and Pegasus Kid, Chris Benoit, going over Osamu Kido and Masa Saito. And a boxer versus wrestler match featuring the debuting Tony Halm going over the Soul Taker, our good friend Papa Shango, Kama, the Godfather, etc., etc. Now, Chad, we lost a year of Fujinami, like prime Fujinami, from 89 to 90. And when he came back, he still had some really great matches, but he was definitely not the same guy as he was in the late 80s.
Yeah, yeah. It's one of those things because, I mean, you don't want to, I guess I wouldn't want to dog on him because, like, yeah, 91, I liked the Vader match from early 91. I liked the Flair series, but you're talking about someone that has a really strong claim to be the best wrestler worldwide for the 1980s. Certainly on the short list, I think. And he just never was that wrestler again when he came back from this injury. Not even close to that level. I mean, probably not even, I don't know, like top 10 or 15 even in the country of Japan, I would say.
And what it is, I mean, it's pretty simple. It comes down to he was such a dynamic athlete, and he didn't have that anymore.
Yeah, he just couldn't have that. I mean, one thing with the early Fujinami and even the later 80s is, right, what Big said. I mean, he had such, like, snap and athleticism where you really feel like you're watching someone that could excel in something other than wrestling but has chosen wrestling. I mean, he has that type of, I guess, crispness to himself in the ring.
And he also moved around the ring like no one else, too. Right. Like, I was listening to, I think it was Carino on Jim Ross's podcast. He was talking about, like, footwork, how it's one of the things that wrestlers notice. Fans don't really know they notice it, but it's like they can tell, oh, this guy moves around the ring a certain way that's different from other people. Oh, this guy trips over his feet, blah, blah, blah. And, like, I guess that's Fujinami. He was so distinct in the way he moved and stuff. And he just didn't have that anymore after the injury. I mean, like, he was still a really good, excellent wrestler. But I don't think he figured, like, I think eventually when he figured out the whole Muga throwback thing, it was probably too late. Like, to make that his gimmick, I think if he had done that earlier, he probably would have had a little more legs as a top guy than he did. I mean, what do you think about that, Chris?
I think definitely. And I think that also he got more into the political side as well of wrestling towards the, you know, as the 90s went on, of course, became the president of New Japan as you know, later on. But yeah, totally. I think if he would have changed his style up earlier, it definitely would have been a benefit for him. But I guess he just tried to do what he knew to do. What made him successful. And I say he still, you know, had success in doing it. I mean, well, I guess really won the world heavyweight title from Flair in 91 and had some, you know, really great matches. I know he had the G1 matches. I mean, he had some strong stuff, but again, it wasn't 1987, 1988 Fujinami.
And he also just physically looked older.
Yes. Yeah. The time away definitely hurt him. And there's been other cases like that too, definitely. You could say the same thing for Austin. You know, when Austin took all that time off for his neck. So,
Austin came back a better worker, though.
He came back a better worker, but he was different, though. I would say it was different. Maybe, and Fujinami probably could have taken the example from that.
Austin, Austin was taking more risks, though. I mean, well, first he did the more technical style, but then he also started taking bigger bumps and stuff again, too.
So. Well, I guess where the difference is he was able to gain the trust. You know, he trusted himself, and maybe Fujinami didn't trust himself as much anymore.
Not that Fujinami should have been taking back body drops onto the ramp.
No.
But Austin. But yeah, and Austin. I mean, Austin kind of did what at first when Austin first came back, he did what we're saying Fujinami should have done.
He was working
a more technical style.
Yeah. Now talk about Anima Hamaguchi. He had been off for a while doing his little deal. It was the bodybuilding. Wasn't that right, Bix?
I don't remember.
He was doing something, and he comes back and does a series of matches and team up with Choshu, but the. You know, everybody remembers the Choshu Saito team. They remember the Choshu Yatsu team. But the Choshu Hamaguchi team was right up there with those two.
That guy was just like a little... I don't want to say fire plug or spark plug because it just sounds so stereotypical or not stereotypical.
He was a buzzsaw.
But he was just hell on wheels. He just constantly moving and... But not in a way where there was no psychology to it or anything. I mean, he was like... In a way, he's almost like the epitome of that Choshu's Army style.
Totally.
As far as the theme of the matches and stuff, kind of what they personified in ring, yeah.
He was just super, and like he doesn't get enough credit. He's become a very forgotten guy.
Oh, totally, because he retired, you know, so early. I mean, he was. Not young when he retired, but he retired so early in the Japanese wrestling boom as far as American fans that, yeah, he totally gets forgotten about.
Well, and also because the rediscovery of a lot of that 80s stuff like was via All Japan Classics. And
he went on there.
Right, because Mrs. Baba was so angry, she was like, you know, don't run any of the Choshu stuff and run almost none of the Tenryu stuff. Apparently it was Mrs. Baba. I don't know.
And Hamaguchi did end up on some of those classics and singles matches.
Yeah, like was the Jumbo match on Classics?
I think so, yes.
Okay. But still, I mean, most of it wasn't on there.
Yeah. Because he was teaming with Choshu. You know, he was his main partner. But real quick before we move on from New Japan, we got to talk about Tony Holm. Vic, Tony Holm had worked as the Viking, I think, for Herb Abrams right around this time period, and then went over to New Japan.
I thought that was later. I don't know.
I was reading The Observer that's where he was known from.
He was on those early shows then. Okay.
Yeah, he's on those early shows. But talk about the shittiness of Tony Holm.
I think people got a taste of this Ludwig Borga, but I don't think you get quite the sense of it until you see him in Japan, where he's just dragging things down to that degree. Like, I guess people would give shit to Scott Norton, but he's an underrated guy. And I mean, there were certain things he put together later, but I think when you see Holma, you don't realize just how good some of the other guys were at adjusting to Japan. Not that Holma was good in the first place, ever good, but he just didn't do anything. And here he is as like this, I mean, I guess allegedly he had boxing experience. What was the story? Who was it? Was it Norton that he got into a fight with?
Yes.
And people who saw the fight suddenly questioned whether or not he had ever been a boxer.
Yeah.
So
well, he actually did fight. He actually did have professional fights.
Right. Well, the question was how legitimate those fights were.
Well, yeah, but he actually did fight professionally. He did have actual boxing matches.
He did. Actual boxing matches in the sense they happened.
Yeah, but I mean, they were commissioned by athletic commissions.
Oh, he did fight in the U.S.?
I mean, it wasn't like he was fighting. He's got 13-6 boxing record.
But where was he fighting? And
let's see here. I'm going on BoxRec right now.
Remember, also BoxRec shows the record of the opponents too.
He also, I mean, he fought his first pro fights were in the U.S.
Okay.
I mean, he's fighting a bunch of guys were job guys, but.
Not that there aren't setups in the U.S.
He fought in Caesars. He fought in Vegas. He fought the Forum. in Los Angeles. He fought the Aladdin invasion.
I love that his box rec photo is of him as Ludwig Borga.
Yeah, he beat Iran Barkley, although Iran Barkley was well past his prime at that point. But he did beat Iran Barkley. That's what the biggest name he beat. But yeah, I mean, a lot of the guys he fought were a bunch of scrubs.
Wait. Am I looking at this correctly? Is there a second page I can go to, or all of his fights on BoxRec after New Japan?
Oh, after New Japan.
Okay.
After WWF.
That's what I'm saying then. So he doesn't actually have a BoxRec record from
professional
when he
background
came in as the boxer.
He may have had amateur.
Okay, but still.
But yeah, he still doesn't change the fact that it sucked. Yes. And real quick before we go, Chad, as among the gimmicks that Soul Taker had, where would you rank the Soul Taker gimmick?
I don't know. Papa Shango scared me as a kid, so that's kind of default number one, I guess. I don't know. Kama, I actually thought could have been a pretty cool gimmick, if it wasn't just in an awful period of 95 WWF when it was really getting pushed. Godfather was more of a moment in time, so I mean I think it's probably his most maybe drab gimmick.
Generic.
Yeah, kind of is. That's a good word. That's
what about Kama Mustafa?
No, that's up there. Nation of Domination, Kama's.
Now, see, I like the Soul Taker. I thought that actually, when it comes down to it, I preferred him as a Soul Taker than any other gimmick.
I did kind of like him as a Soul Taker, and he had a good swagger to him.
Yeah, because he's basically playing. He was himself in a lot of ways, and in Global, in the early days of Global, I mean, I thought he was he could have been a pretty big star there if they would have stayed. Of course, he went to WWF. But
didn't he team with Bad News in the tag tournament?
Yes, he sure did.
Yeah.
And they had a cool vibe together.
Yeah, it makes sense. Just real quick,
compared to some of the challengers that Lawler was having in USWA too, I mean, he was in the upper echelon there of your King Cobras and all that. So.
And he was not a terrible promo either.
No.
No, he could talk. He definitely could talk.
And that never really got as an actual wrestling promo, I mean, you talk plenty of The Godfather, that really never got exploited once he got to the WWF.
Yeah.
I mean, it's weird, too. For a guy who was actually a pretty good promo,
yeah,
he never really got to do much.
Well, we're talking about Japan. We go to UWF version 2, and this is the end of an era. As Akira Maeda defeated Masakatsu Funaki in 1659, with a sleeper hold in the main event of the UWF show on October 25th at Osaka Castle Hall in front of 15,000 fans. In the semifinal, you had Nobuyuki Takada going over Yoshiaki Fujiwara by TKO after knocking him down 5 times in 23-36 in the semifinal. Other matches on this show included Ken Shamrock going over Yoji Anjo in 11-39 with a sleeper hold. Wayne Shamrock, you are correct.
Do you know the story behind that?
He worked as Kenneth Wayne Shamrock, I know, at one point.
Well, he was Ken in All Japan, and they didn't want to be they didn't want to have their guy be the same guy who was basically a job guy in All Japan.
Yeah, even though it was the same dude.
Even though it was the same guy, they wanted to make it seem like it was a different guy, so he was Wayne Shamrock.
And we had, Minoru Suzuki going over Shigeo Miyato in 11-24 by submission. Sasuke Nakano going over Wellington Wilkins Jr. by KO in 4:45, and Masahito Kakihara going over Yusuke Fuke in 10:43 with a sleeper hold. Now, the big story here, though, is after the show, Akira Maeda said that the UWF is only concerned with wrestling inside the ring and not political problems. Maeda said that UWF wrestlers would not be loaned out to any promotions, trying to squash the rumors of a future deal between the UWF and SWS for a possible Tokyo Dome show on December 29th. Now, a few days after our week was over with, Akira Maeda was suspended for 6 months from the UWF by Mr. Jin, who we talked about this on one of the previous shows.
Yeah.
Jin. And that was it. He left. He eventually formed Rings.
Well, the promotion was closed within how many weeks?
Well, they ran one more show in December without Maeda, December 1st, 1990, which the main event of that show was Funaki going over Wayne Shamrock in 1804 by submission. But that was the last show of UWF 2.0. But this is the last show that Maeda worked. So, pretty big deal. And the deal with UWF SWS, again, as we've talked about before, Hachiro Tanaka was one of the big money marks for UWF running the Tokyo Dome shows in 89 and maybe even 88, whatever. And he was one of the big backers. And that's, you know, what it comes down to. And he formed SWS. I'm going to bring in Takada, Fujiwara, Suzuki, and Funaki to work SWS. And Maeda, being the fact that he wants his wrestling to be perceived as real and not like, you know, that crappy pro wrestling, these other promotions put out, you know, put his foot down and said no. And in the end, money won out. But Bix, yeah, this was, like I said, the end of an era in UWF.
Well, right. And then also, just to add to what you're saying, then Tanaka helped fund Fujiwara Gumi at the beginning, and they did put Fujiwara Gumi matches on SWS Tokyo Dome shows, and, Maeda was right, because they didn't fit.
No, they didn't.
And it made them look bad to be on the same show, because it's kind of like, why are you on the same show as fake wrestling, or whatever you want to say, or it make, you know, it's not good for anyone. Because it makes the regular wrestling look faker, but it also casts a bad light on the shoot style.
Exactly.
As far as Maeda, this is the end of Kira Maeda doing anything close to really traditional style pro wrestling. Because when you compare the UWF to all the others, it was more realistic, but it was, relative to what we know now, is actually realistic. It was still not that realistic. Because UWF style was basically the same as what UWFI ended up doing. And I remember when, earlier in the year, I rewatched the weekly Pro Tokyo Dome show from 95 for that article I did for Fighting Spirit. Because on that show, you have UWFI, Pancrase, Rings, and Fujiwara Gumi. And you see them all in the same show. I mean, you know, Fujiwara Gumi has Don Arakawa doing his comedy. They're not really putting up any pretense that it's a shoot anymore. You know, Rings always had a pretty realistic style. Pancrase had works, but had, you know, you get the idea. UWFI looks totally worked compared to all the others. So I totally forgot what my original point was.
Well, think about it for a second.
Right. It was the changes Maeda made. Right. So when he started Rings looked much different from what everyone was used to. Not only did it look different, he didn't use anyone who was known as a pro wrestler. He brought in, you know, Russians and Dutch guys, generally kickboxers and sambo guys, and trained them to wrestle. And some of the natives were from UWF, like Tamura, you know, later on, and some of the other guys. But really, I mean, it was mostly new guys, so it didn't have that much of a pro wrestling association. He did very well with it.
Now, Chad, Maeda leaves. You know, UWFI, you know, forms with Takada on top. And, you know, one of the talking points lately, in the past recent years, is Nobuhiko Takada's reputation has taken a hit. You know, and people consider him being a, quote, fraud, unquote. What are the differences, in your opinion, between Maeda and Takada as the top gods?
Takada's, to me, is an interesting. I find him interesting because, like, if I think about great shoot style matches, he's featured in two of my absolute favorite, and that's the August Vader one and the this show, actually, versus Fujiwara. That does just two absolutely outstanding matches. But Takada on top, I think, when he would do the of course, the more mixture with the other promotions when they did the New Japan versus UWFI feud. Afterwards, when he faces Tenryu later on in 1996, it's an interesting prospect, and it's certainly, I think you could see a change from where Takada was. But of course, I mean, just judging by what Maeda did by forming rings, Takada's certainly more welcoming to a pro style, because the UWFI versus New Japan is a pretty pro wrestling angle type invasion angle. Interpromotional feud, and then his match with Tenryu is the same way. Whereas Maeda always did seem to try to accomplish a more realist aspect of it. Both of them, in comparing them kind of as workers or aces, I think they each have flaws, where Takada can be passive at times and seems to work to the level of his opponent and let his opponent dictate. But I can also see an argument that that's sort of a stoic behavior that he is portraying. So I think it's an interesting contrast between the two, especially because, I mean, really, as far as a presentation standpoint, I mean, UWFI certainly is more, you know, no context really kind of a shoots, or I mean, there's suplexes, there's half crabs, there's a lot going on that's radically different from rings. But compared to UWF 2.0, I don't think it's that far of a difference from that in UWFI. There's some similarities, but I think both Takada and Maeda's workers feel pretty different in their philosophies on top.
I mean, Maeda feels like he kind of talked to these guys to figure out what's going to look more real. You know what I mean? Like,
right,
UWF style looks like, yeah, a bunch of guys who have never been in a real fight, a bunch, yeah, of pro wrestlers who have never been in a fight, or never been in a kind of like an organized fight, trying to figure out what it would look like. Rings looks like you have those Sambo guys kind of trying to help him figure out what a realistic work looks like. Because you look at those now, I mean, you could tell that they're works, but the holes are not that wide open.
No. Yeah, very close-knit. And by the same token, I think Takada's certainly someone that he, I guess, emphasizes dramatic effect, you know, where it's not, this looks real, it's how do we build to the most satisfying conclusion. In his mind, which usually meant him going over, but that's kind of beside the fact.
Well, on that point, though, I'd say, you know, for that reason, Takada, I would make the argument Takada's even better as a traditional pro-style wrestler. Like, there are some really great standout UWFI matches, but if I feel like I'm thinking of what my favorite Takada matches are, they're mostly in New Japan, whereas Maeda, he does have some standout New Japan matches, but a lot of them are tag matches. And really, if you think of the best the best Maeda matches, you're mostly thinking of the high-end ring stuff like with Volkan.
Totally.
Yeah.
It seems like Takada at the heart of it was more of a pro wrestler than anything else, while Maeda just completely hated pro wrestling, you know, and just his passion was that realistic style.
Maeda was more like Funaki.
Yes, totally.
Yeah, Funaki's an interesting character too in all this, like kind of what happens to him, because I never get a sense, it's something kind of with chronicling and the whole shoot style situation in the 90s I find extremely fascinating, but Funaki and Pancrase, just how highly he was viewed in Japan, I guess it was pretty highly because he did get into the Hall of Fame based on that, but it's certainly interesting with that. Now going back and watching his stuff in UWF 2.0, even this match that we referenced on this show with Maeda and Funaki, it's a lot of slap exchanges, a lot of kind of really them trying to holds and grappling, not working of body parts, or like we said, building up to a crescendo, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly. Well, on that note, we're going to take a quick break and let the place the B-Boys pay the bills. And when we come back, we'll go to Mexico and discuss a big mass match featuring Atlantis. Wow. Where have we heard that lately? We'll be right back after this.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation. PlaceToBeNation.com. The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes and PlaceToBeNation.com. You can check out myself and Scott Criscolo on The Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, home of great interviews and our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. If you need your fix of current wrestling talk, we have plenty of options for you there, including Main Events, which features a roundtable discussion led by PTBN analysts and special guests, our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, including immediate feedback and discussion for WWE, NXT, Ring of Honor, and New Japan Super Show, and Wrestling with Optimism, which focuses on the positives of the business. Also, be sure to relive wrestling's past through Graham Cawthon's excellent exclusive History of Wrestling podcast, Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave's Wrestling Culture podcast, our monthly pay-per-view rewind roundtable series led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance podcast starring myself and Pro Wrestling Only's Will, diving into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. Sports fans have plenty to dive into as well. We feature The Extra Point with Scott Criscolo and Dr. G, The Kings of Sport featuring Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, The Sports Sound hosted by Cowboy and Cowboy Sr., as well as the NBA Team Podcast, which takes a year-round deep dive into pro hoops. PTBN also proudly features Richard and the Mailman podcast, which specializes in the world of TV, thought leadership, anger, and irreverence. As mentioned, all these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. PTBN is also home to the tremendous in-depth features on pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments, and more. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island in Fall River, Massachusetts, Scott Keats, RSPWFAQ.com blog, and Piledriver.net.
Do you watch pro wrestling? Do you love pro wrestling? We do too. And there's only one podcast feed that you can't miss.
PWO PTBN Podcast Network. That's the pro wrestling only Place to Be Nation Podcast Network.
We have a host of brilliant shows dedicated to wrestling past and present.
Whether it's the territories, Japan, Lucha, old school or new school, we've got something for you.
Get a dose of history on Exile on Bad Street with Chris Zellner.
Listen to reviews of current pay-per-views on the PTBN reaction shows. Not just WWE, but New Japan, Ring of Honor, and NXT. And get your weekly update on everything else that's going on in the indies, lucha, and beyond on This Week in Wrestling.
Relive WCW Supercards on Where the Big Boys Play with Parv and Chad.
Join Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave on one of the very best shows for super hardcore nerds, Wrestling Culture.
Go deep into WWF history and discover the Bob Backlund and Bruno Sammartino eras on Titans of Wrestling.
Don't miss the Pro Wrestling Super Show with Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston.
You can get the full archive of Goodwill Wrestling with Good Old Will from Texas.
There's Tag Teams back again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze.
Then there's the only pro wrestling game show, Brainbuster, with me, Johnny Sorrow, and a panel of great guests every time.
Get them all on one feed.
PWO-PTBN Podcast Network.
You know you want to hear it.
All right, we're back. And listen to all those great podcasts on the Place to Be Nation Network, especially mine. And we're now going to Mexico, and we're in EMLL, and they have a huge show in Arena Mexico on October 26th, drawing 18,000 fans. And here are your key matches of said show, as we have Liz Mark, Mascara Sagrada, and Sangre Chicana going over El Fabuloso Blondie, Ken Timms, Herodes, and Perov Jr. What a team that is. Then we have El Faraón, Rayo de Jalisco Jr., and Ringo Mendoza going over Pedro Aguayo, Cien Caras, and Pirata Morgan. Then we have a match that was described as not as good as some of their other matches, but we have El Dandy going over El Satanico. And then our main event, Máscara contra Máscara, we have Atlantis going over Kung Fu, who unmasked as Raimundo Cuesta Vellos, 39 years old with 22 years experience from Baja California, with Dave Meltzer saying that he thought that the Sting Sid Vicious match from Halloween Havoc was much better than this. And also a little side note, we had Atlantis having a singles match with El Dandy 2 days before for the NWA middleweight title at the Plaza de Toros El Cortillo del Distrito Federal on October 24th that went around 40 minutes. It was said to be awesome. So that's one of those matches that you wish was on tape. But yeah, that Atlantis Kung Fu match is, woof. It's not one of the better mass matches you'll see, but this promotion was red hot this time. You know, the Anniversario was the month earlier. This is now, they're now back in Arena Mexico because they had been kicked out, by, even though they own the building. They had been kicked out because of all the things that went on before at the Anniversario show. But, Biggs, this is, like I said, this is a hot promotion. And that's, you know, they would be riding the waves for the next year and a half.
Hot promotion at the gate, and also, boy, did they have a great in-ring year.
Oh, totally. Their talent roster was amazing at this time period. I mean, they had, you know, almost all the best guys around. Even though there was still, UWA was still going, and we'll talk about them in a minute. But, I mean, they had so much deep talent. And it's just, you know, you see shows like this and a wow. But, Chad, the, you know, we talk about El Dandy going over Satanico. They had great matches, you know, for many years and having matches in 2015. And then we have, you know, this Atlantis El Dandy match. And we talked about this before with other people on this show. El Dandy is always, sadly, going to be remembered by most people for that Bret Hart promo. Who are you to doubt El Dandy? But talk about El Dandy's greatness as a performer.
Well, El Dandy had just a great kind of stretch, and he still is, you know, good even to the stuff that's made tape in 2015. But I think his 1990 especially, you cannot kind of underrate that year as a whole, because going through the entire year and watching a lot of the footage, there was a lot of really great performers worldwide. I mean, Jumbo Tsuruta had a great year. El Satanico had an amazing year, but it still wasn't, in my opinion, as good as El Dandy, who his 1990 is just incredible. And this match in particular, that's kind of interesting that it's not as good as some of the other ones, because while I do prefer the hair versus hair match they have in December, I think this is probably my second favorite match they've ever had with each other. And to me, this match is sort of weird in that it's almost like their it's almost like their greatest hits match, because there's brawling, there's wrestling. It kind of does the whole spectrum of what these two performers can show, but it's a cohesive match nonetheless. And even, I mean, just running through that card, I've never looked at it all together, but that trios before that match, I mean, like you said, you have Ryo and CN Cars that were still, a month removed from their record-setting match at the Anniversario show. Then you have El Faron and Parada Morgan, who are just kind of starting their feud, and they have a great match in November. This is a promotion that was firing on all cylinders. And even the main event, which you think about Atlantis, his last, I guess, three signature mass matches I've all put in kind of the classic canon of Lucha Apuestas matches. And this match with Kung Fu certainly is not up to that, but it's still a big deal and, you know, a nice notch on the belt career-wise of Atlantis to take Kung Fu's mask here.
Yeah, and Bix, you know, Kung Fu was, you know, kind of past his prime at this point, but as a member of Los Fantásticos, you know, a good 5 to 10 years earlier, I mean, they were a groundbreaking team in Lucha Libre.
Yeah, I mean, he was a really good worker. I mean, and, you know, Los Fantásticos, I mean, I guess what modern fans would know them for is more the way they kind of inspired the great Sasuke persona, I guess.
Yes.
But, you know, really cool. So wait, I'm trying to remember. Kung Fu, Kendo, and Black Man?
Not Kendo, yeah. It was Black Man, Kato, Kung Lee, and Kung Fu.
Did they do a new Fantástico with
Kendo? Yes,
Kendo,
yes.
Okay, that's what I was thinking of.
When Kung Fu and Kato had their falling out, And that, of course, they had their mask match in 88, where Kung Fu took Kato's mask.
Yeah, I mean, all really, really good workers. And I mean, even Kendo was a really good worker, too. I mean, he eventually kind of, like, he'd go to Japan and do a lot of shtick sometimes, but he was, and they're all really very similar style with the hopping and the martial arts and the...
Yeah, they did a lot of high flying.
And a lot of regular, you know, lucha high
flying. And that's what broke their bodies down. So about this time, you know, doing work in 22 years, you can see where a guy like Kung Fu would be broken down.
Yes.
Now, moving on to the other promotion in the country, UWA.
Well, I did have something I wanted to mention, though. That
okay, go ahead.
Because we probably have a lot of people who are listening that don't really know much about lucha. We probably should mention what you were talking about with why Arena Mexico was closed.
Elaborate on that real quickly.
Okay, so as Chad alluded to, Rayo de Jalisco versus Cien Caras at the anniversary show in the mask match was big record-setting match. Still the second largest crowd in the history of Mexico at the time. It was the largest, but it's at Arena Mexico. So how does that happen? So how do they get 23,000 people into Arena Mexico, which seats about 18? That's because thousands of fans overpowered security, congregated in the upper deck, and did structural damage to the building. And honestly, because that is... When was that? Okay, wait a second. What day is the show we just talked about?
October 26th, so it's a month and 5 days.
Okay, you know what it is? Because I'm looking at... I thought so because I'm looking at Jason Campbell's site and he has it as October 21st. I'm like, wait a second, that's wrong. So yeah, so it was a little over a month. So it was less time than I thought it was. And then I'm looking at this, it's like, okay, that wasn't a week. So thousands of people break it. So type of thing that would never happen again. And to make sure it didn't happen for the really big mask matches, like I know. Blue Panther versus Love Machine was one of them. They started putting screens in the parking lot to keep that from happening. And I mean, nothing like that ever happened again, did it? Even when there was big demand, right?
No, they never had that type of stuff happening.
But yeah, still the all time number two attendance in Mexico, the biggest still being first Triple Mania.
Yeah,
and
speaking of a boring, I said. You're going to UWA in front of a 14,000 seat house at the, which was $40,000 gate at the El Torreo de Cuatro Caminos de Nacopan.
They're still hot too. I mean, they're 14,000.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah,
the same metro area, for people who don't know, Nacopan is part of the Mexico City metro area. I mean, it's not like it's right next door, but it's close. I mean, this is, I guess you would say, kind of like a Dallas Fort Worth type.
That's exactly what I was about to say. It's almost like a Fort Worth Dallas because one of my coworkers is actually from Nacopan. So, yeah.
So, I mean, that they're doing this level of business is pretty impressive that they're both drawing as well. But go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, the main event was Los Brazos, you know, Oro, Plata, and El Brazo. Going over Los Villanos, Villano 1, Villano 4, and Villano 5 to win the UWA Trios titles back. Of course, this feud, these two teams battle for many years.
Mass match
in 88, and they fought for these titles numerous times. And also set up a Máscara contra Caballera match the next week with Villano 1 putting up his mask against El Brazo's hair, which you know the outcome of that.
I have a question about this.
Yes.
Was the feud, at least until, you know, Villano 1, you know, stopped wrestling? Wait, or was Villano... Who was the one that died young? Villano 2?
Yes.
Okay. So was the feud with the Brazos until Villano 1 retired, was that primarily with him and 4 and 5, with 3 being a singles?
Mainly, yes.
Because he's the one in... Wait, who... Because he's the one in the Mask versus Mask match, right? 3 isn't...
I think it's 1, 3, and 4.
Okay, but still, I mean, but... Primarily, he was in the feud.
Yes, he was. Yeah, he was one of the main cogs in the feud.
When did he stop wrestling?
Villano 1? Let me see. You know, he died young. He died in 2001. People don't know about that.
When did he stop wrestling long before?
He basically left when UWA quit in 95. he was a guy that never really went to MLL much. Very little. I mean, he mainly stayed in UWA.
Even when he stayed true. Using UWA guys.
Yeah, he basically became more of a trainer than anything else after 91. So, and he trained a lot of the guys. You know, I think Cibernetico was one of the main guys he trained, which, you know, may not be one of the best things you want to put on your record. But, I mean, he did have a hand in his training and other guys.
Could be electroshock.
Yeah, well, that's Negro Casas.
Really? The,
yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, UWA was still successful at this time. And the thing is, this show was supposed to have, originally they were wanting to get Owen on this show, Bader, which Bader was in Japan. They wanted this to be a big, big show, but it just fell apart because everybody else's travel commitments. And they, and of course those guys would come in later on, but, yeah, I mean, just, they were still hot. Now, Chad, Brazos Villanos is a, you know, transcending feud among Lucha Libre. Brazos were on the Hall of Fame ballot this year. They've been on the past couple of years. You'd think that the Villanos, I know Villano Tercero has been on there as a singles guy, but do you think that it would have been better served for them maybe to be on as a team? Or do you think that it's better for Tercero to be a singles and the others just not even be on it altogether?
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. I know during your Lucha Hall of Fame exile, you kind of posed that question with Super Porky on the Brazos side. But, I really don't know. Because, I mean, I think about, like, hypothetical, and UWA is something, I mean, as I've gotten more immersed with Lucha in the past, I'd say 5 or 6 years, certainly, but really with the UWA and kind of reading more on the historical side, just because of the lack of footage that kind of persists from them. It's kind of learning about just how successful some of these trios were as a unit. I mean, the Villanos and the Brazos kind of were the two, I would say, signature ones for that promotion, had the longstanding feud. Now Villano Tercero had so many great singles matches. I mean, the stuff that we do have a tape of him, he feels like a great kind of singles worker that could also branch out. But, I mean, I guess you look at the percentage of his Hall of Fame vote, and that hasn't been conveyed with the voters that are voting in that region. So who knows? I mean, I would honestly say I think if all Villanos were on the ballot, that I don't think they would fare any better probably than Villano Tercero has fared as a singles so far, because you may even get some residue of I remember these guys in WCW,
yeah,
kind of
exactly
out on pro, which is unfair, but that's kind of the way it is.
Now,
back to the El Dandy thing.
Now, Chris, yeah, you would, if you're going to put a Brazo as a singles candidate, you would put Porky. You wouldn't put Brazo de Oro.
Brazo de Oro had better singles matches than Super Porky. I mean, that's just a matter of fact.
And I feel like in their prime, he was more the single star than Porky was.
Yeah, he was always the champion. I mean, he would win titles, singles titles. He was like Villano Tercero.
So I'm curious why you're putting Porky out as the example, though.
Porky became, I think, a bigger star post-split.
Post-prime, yeah, but...
I mean, he's the guy everybody knows.
Yeah, I guess Porky is a personality.
Like, he was in WWE, for God's sakes.
But I think the whatchamacallit. But I think
he's a bigger star. He's a bigger star.
But I think
he's
from
a much
Hall of Fame
star
perspective, I don't think you can put any of the Brazos individually at Villano Tercero's level.
No, yeah, I would agree.
He's drawn more money. He's drawn more money than the other one. He's had more high profile hair matches as a singles guy.
Yeah, but in the prime, it's Brazo de Oro. Post prime, it's Brazo de Plata. I think is the best.
Yeah, but even no matter what, though, even when they were in their prime, Porky was always still the star.
He was the star, yes. He was the star, okay, in terms of he was the spotlight and he was the most charismatic one. All that, but Brazo de Oro got the bigger singles matches.
Yes.
Like the Santo match.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And we'll stay in Mexico, although this is like our potpourri segment. And we'll talk about a strange situation here as Juan Ortiz Cruz, a.k.a. El Tigre de Bengala, who was the key witness in the case against Frey Tormenta, which alleged that Tormenta had physically and sexually abused the boys he was housing and selling them around the United States, was arrested himself this week for filing false police reports, as the Mexico City police believed the charges that were made against Tormenta were without merit and was simply made because of the bad blood between the two men. Cruz was heavily involved in Tormenta's orphanage, and the belief is that after they had a falling out, Cruz made up the abuse charges to try and get his former boss imprisoned. The selling of the children part was pretty much swept under the rug, though, because everyone believed that the kids were better off for being sold to families in the United States. During this whole process, Tormenta had gotten seriously ill and had to be hospitalized, which garnered sympathy from the people of Mexico City. Now, for those of you that don't know, the movie Nacho Libre with Jack Black is based off of Frey Tormenta.
And not the first one, because there's that French movie with Jean Reno and Marley Matlin, too, with Jean Reno as Frey Tormenta.
Exactly.
Or Frey Tormenta type.
But Bix, this was a pretty big deal in this time period. I mean, this was a huge national store in Mexico.
And it tainted Frey Tormenta for a very long time. Unfortunately. Yes. Mean, as far as, I mean, say what you want to with stuff about priests and molestations. I mean, as we never heard any kind of legit story, any stories. I mean, this is where all of the rumors and stuff came from, was this, which, as far as we can tell, is bullshit. So he really got unfairly painted for the bad rap for a long time. And then wasn't there a wrestler working at the orphanage that did turn out to be abusing the kids, but then also that Frey Tormenta didn't know about it? Like, what was his name? Super Khan?
Yes.
And again, that kind of, as far as I know, it was something that Frey Tormenta did not know about, but he still got kind of painted with that brush because it went on under his watch. And also, when you're talking about selling the kids, like, because you're saying it in the same breath as, you know, as molesting them, and I'm like, wait, is he saying, does they mean selling them into slavery? And I'm like, no. Oh. And then I see later you're selling, like, oh, sold, like adoption selling.
Yes.
That kind of actually gave me a little bit of relief there. When you're saying that's true, I'm like, oh, wait, what? And then you said that. So, yeah, you know what's weird? This reminds me of, like, did you see that SNL documentary that was on a couple weeks ago?
SNL, that's in
Saturday Night Live.
They're talking about the which one?
The new one that was on a couple weeks ago, like the same night as the season opener, I think.
I didn't know there was a new one.
There was a new one. It was not. It was like a tying into the anniversary. It might have, like, they might have had a theatrical thing or something separate. I think this was new, and it had about the people's reaction to the Sinead O'Connor thing.
I haven't seen that, no.
Okay, and it was like Chris Rock kind of joking about, well, doesn't everyone kind of feel like assholes now for treating her the way they did? And, like, he's like, priests? Why could anyone hate priests? And it's kind of interesting for me to see. I mean, yeah, you've got the orphanage aspect with this, but it's interesting for me to see this. That the first thing that Tigre de Bengala goes to is molesting the kids, when here that was less of an association people had with priests back then. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah, it wasn't not nearly as big as it is now as a story. It was swept under the rug. But still, Tormenta still does, I mean, to this day, he still has his orphanage. He still does shows every week there, you know, using, I guess, the boys that live there and ones that used to live there that still, you know, work around the area.
And of course, they used that whole concept to get and to show just how much it did eventually blow over in terms of, especially since he had nothing to do with any of the bad stuff, you know, but that they used him successfully to launch the Mystico gimmick.
Exactly. Yep. Exactly. That's where that he was like the mentor.
Well, no, Mystico was supposed to be in the storyline one of the orphans.
Yeah, so he was the mentor.
Yeah, and yeah, this reminds me. I'm trying to remember. I think it was Kurt Brown once that sent me. He had like the little pamphlet thing they give you, like, at Cauliflower Alley, because Fray Tormenta would be sometimes at the reunions. He would have a table where, I guess, I don't know if he just took donations or he sold gimmicks that would be for donations. And it's like this little thing that says, like, you know, thank you for donating to the, yeah, just a little, whatever, little trinket to the orphanage of Father Fray Tormenta. Of course, Kurt just took one off the table when he wasn't looking and eventually sent it to me. I think it was Kurt. If it was someone else, then no, Kurt did not steal a pamphlet from the good father.
Now, Chad, do you know?
I think I just completely know.
I'm just moving on. Chad, did you have you heard know much about Fray Tormenta?
No. This when I got the notes, this was the I guess the one section where I was unfamiliar with either of the principles involved. So I did, you know, limited Google.
Yeah, man, because a lot of stuff on he doesn't even. It's none of his stuff is really on tape.
Right. So right.
It's just. But yeah, definitely the Nacho Libre stuff was based off of that. So
also lots of when there would be English language documentaries, they'd always cover him. I remember the big one being the National Geographic Explorer thing from 91 maybe, that had him. Do you remember the one I'm talking about? Because I think it aired like right after an episode of WCW. Chris?
Yeah, it was sometime in that time period.
Of course, it was always him and Super Barrio.
Yeah.
Even though Super Barrio was never actually a star, right?
No.
He was just a guy that was really good at getting publicity, and people who were interested in writing, people from America who were interested in learning about Lucha would always take like this, what's the word I'm looking for? Like anthropological slant. So they'd always want to write about Super Barrio.
Yeah.
Kind of the way you see it.
Yeah. Yeah. He knew how to get his name out there. He was good at that. So. He knew who to get in touch with. Now, sticking with Potpourri, as this really doesn't have anything yet regarding a section, but
it's international, sort of.
It's international,
sort of,
and it's stuff that we've touched on kind of on this show before, and hopefully one day I will have a special show on this subject. But Joe Pedicino told the Pro Wrestling Torch that Congi Sports is coming closer every day to starting up, and they hope by the first of the year they will be ready to roll. Pedicino said that they are talking to groups in Japan right now about helping them. Now, Steve Beverly reported in Matt Watch that UWF's boss, Herb Abrams, called Pedicino trying to form an alliance, but Pedicino was non-committal. Abrams was trying to sell Pedicino on the notion that NBC International is going to syndicate his shows overseas. Oh. Bix, this is one of your favorite deals, too. Congi Sports.
Yeah.
Oh, those no Nigerians. I mean, we've talked about this.
I don't know if we've talked about it since we got the mat washers, though, have we?
We talked about it some, but this was a I guess maybe give again a brief summation of Congi Sports.
Joe was approached by a Nigerian man named Olu Oliami, who had money in a, what was it? An international bank in New York?
Just so happened to be in New York,
yes.
It was
something like that. $25 million. And he would invest in a new wrestling promotion for him. Now, okay. I guess we won't go into this too deep, but what it seems like this all came out of him being Nigerian 419 scammed. But I'm trying to figure out how that happens in 1990 and to the point where the guy flies into the States and all that. I mean, I guess maybe it required more work back then without the internet, but you can tell that that's what happened, especially like if you read the interviews with Joe, like in hindsight, it's like, oh my God. Cause you saw like a month or two back when I was looking through the Matt watches from around this time and just screen grabbing stuff and tweeting it. You saw that, right?
Yes.
So it's like all of these warning signs that are just sound like Nigerian emails, you know, from modern times. And you know, I think back to, you know, Bruce Mitchell, who we had on last week, wrote that column in 92 once Pedicino was done with Global about, you know, kind of, is he a fool or is he a liar? And that the whole thing sounded, that the Nigerian part sounded so far-fetched, and now it doesn't.
Yeah. Again, I don't want to really go so really in deep on this, because it definitely
we will deserves, at some point. Even if we don't have Joe on, we will.
Yeah, we definitely need to have some type of show about this. But Chad's on here with me. Chad, again, a Georgia guy. Joe Pedicino was like a godsend to us. What are your memories of Joe Pedicino's influence in Atlanta wrestling?
Yeah, that's kind of the thing with this whole situation is, I mean, I kind of touched on a little bit of my lineage as a wrestling fan, but I mean, growing up when I did, one of the fondest things that I really remember but can't quite piece together is the big wrestling block on Saturday night, because I was, of course, too young to stay up and watch it, but I would videotape some of it. And Joe Pedicino and Bonnie Blackstone were really authoritative figures for me for a lot of my childhood in regards to wrestling. I still have the first house show I went to in the Omni, my first house show ever. I still have a picture somewhere that I need to dig up out of my parents' basement of me with Bonnie Blackstone and Joe Pedicino. And so this whole situation with the Congi sports, I mean, I guess the more you read, the badder, the worse it sounds in retrospect. But it just seems odd because, I mean, like, even now, you know, Chris, I mean, Joe runs some radio stations on a local level. He seems like a fairly solid, put together businessman.
Totally. He made a lot of money.
Yeah. It's just like this one thing that I don't know how he got kind of bamboozled this bad over this one situation, or if he was just more hoping it was true that he wasn't kind of looking at all the warning signs. But
how do you conceive of this in 1990 though? These warning signs that we have now are from being inundated with
this. That's true. That is true.
Reading 419 Eater. You know,
yeah, this is an early version of that. And regarding Joe and the money, you know, Joe eventually got into radio working with Clear Channel on a local level as one of their bosses in the area. He bought radio stations. That's what he does now. He runs a country station that's kind of based mainly out of Fayetteville, which is right down the road from Chad, but Noonan, in that whole area, Noonan, Carrollton, Fayetteville area, and going to Griffin. And so, he's really successful, but yeah, I mean, this was a bad business move. But, you know, this was the beginning of it. It would get way worse later. That's for sure. And as a natural segue from the Joe Pedicino deal, we go to the USWA.
Which is honestly a section you could have put that in, but
yeah, because later on he would try to buy the USWA.
Yeah, but he wasn't at that point yet, so it's technically pulpery.
Yeah, it's still Jerry Jarrett owned USWA, and
Well,
Mark Callis was supposed to come in and face Jerry Lawler in the main event of the October 22nd Mid-South Coliseum show, but he no showed. And Lawler beat a masked rookie named MC Jammer, how creative of a name, in 45 seconds to retain his unified heavyweight title. Lawler had gone on TV on October 20th and said that he would add Mark to the list of his famous victims that he's pinned. And Mark was then advised by the WWF that he didn't need to be pinned, so he just didn't show up.
So when was he already known to be going to WWF? Like, because I'm trying to think, how many weeks after the USWA title tournament is this?
It's
2 weeks.
Yeah, so it was around.
I think
this
it was like
period.
October 8th was the tournament.
Yeah, so this is right in the middle of that, because they had already started coming up with gimmick plan. Well, I don't think they cared about the tournament deal.
Well, because he didn't get pinned in the tournament.
Yeah. It was Lawler in this promo on television, explicitly saying what he's going to do. Lawler knowing where he's going. And, of course, they had that. They could put that on television. you know, God knows they've done it before.
They've done it with guys that he didn't pin either, so.
Yeah, so, I mean, I get, and a month later, of course, he would come in as The Undertaker, but it was a smart move on Mark's part, and supposedly Vince McMahon was one of the main ones to tell him that himself. But, yeah, MC Jammer. I don't even remember MC Jammer.
I know I remember the name.
I remember the name, but I don't remember what he looked like or anything.
Was there a second version of MC Jammer?
It could have been.
There was a semi-pushed MC Jammer, and maybe it was even the same guy, but...
Yeah. Now, me and Mark Callis, Chad, everybody remembers The Undertaker and stuff like that, but, you know, this 1 year he worked as Mean Mark, I mean, I thought, watching at the time, I thought he was going to be a major superstar in that gimmick. But, of course, you know, WCW is WCW. But you talk about the differences between Mean Mark and The Undertaker.
Yeah, going back, I mean, he looks really impressive. And, I mean, he's very agile. Like, you still see some of his agile stuff where he was doing his leg drop, power moves, but I guess it was also more of his maybe his later Booger Red persona, I would say, kind of cropping up.
Yeah,
where he was
yes,
just sort of like a roughneck biker ass type dude that you didn't want to mess with. But also on that Memphis show, the one where Lawler all that stuff happens, they show a video package of Mark Callis beforehand to like hype him up. And then all that happens, so that's even more humorous that they basically promote him and then knowing what Lawler says later on in the show, just as like a burial.
Now, I'm trying to remember, did they acknowledge that he was Master of Pain?
I don't believe so.
No, they didn't, even though, I mean, it was obvious.
Now, did Lawler Master ever Pain pin Master of Pain?
I know Master of Pain pinned Lawler. Yeah. For the title.
Because if you pin Master of Pain, then unless they just didn't have the tape, then, which is possible, knowing Memphis.
I'm trying to remember who Master of Pain lost to.
The title to?
Yeah, he was the same. I mean, the hair was a little bit different. So, you know, because he was growing his hair out longer to be Undertaker.
And he was a little more muscular.
Right. Yeah. He beat Master of Pain on television.
Okay, so maybe they just didn't have the tape.
Yeah, and I guess maybe they just didn't want to do it because of the hair. But he beat him by DQ on February 11, 1989. He beat him at Mid-South Coliseum on March 20th, 1989. He beat him by DQ on April 3rd, Coliseum. He beat him for the title on April 24th. So he beat him numerous times.
It must be just that they didn't have the tape then, or they thought it didn't look enough, or they knew he was changing his look, and
yeah,
be convincing.
That's probably what it was.
Or they was changing it more, I guess. Now, also with Mean Mark, I mean, he did more stuff than he did as Undertaker too.
He's more animated, definitely in the ring.
Yeah,
more high spots too, though. I mean,
more high spots.
I mean, especially the big one being, which I kind of think he could have done as Undertaker, and probably. Was the, you know, walking the ropes freehand and then doing the elbow drop.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that would have been a cool spot. If
Which
he
was
had
his finisher.
Yeah.
For a while.
Yeah, definitely. Now, going back to Lawler, he also has heat these days with the Mid-South Coliseum manager, Beth Wade, who wants to reinstitute beer sales in the building, which have been banned since July. Now, Lawler's against selling beer at the matches because he believes it increases violence from the fans, and said that he would move wrestling out of the building if they went back on the ban. Lawler also said that a ban on beer would allow the shows to be more family-friendly, which would help everyone out in the long run because when the ban wasn't there, there were too many drunks in the crowd. Now, Wade said that she didn't think the beer was a problem. The building security itself was the problem, and they had a big turnover in that department. Now, the promotion pays for security, so that's the real story here, and that they feel with less beer sold, that means they would need less security. Hence, saving money. Lawler, though, still wants Wade gone because she wants wrestling out any way she can get it out. Yeah, definitely a cost-cutting measure when it all comes down to it in the end. But, you know, Chad, what do you think about Lawler? I mean, we know that Lawler, you know, definitely against alcohol and never took a drink in his life. You know, it's, I mean, I think it's maybe some mixture of personal beliefs and trying to cut money.
Yeah, I agree with that, probably with this stance, but I don't remember which exile from Mid-South Coliseum it was, but I always loved that. Actually, I know a couple of times when they moved out of the building to a smaller venue, one of the things that they would promote on TV was that it was a safer environment, you know, no more metal detectors and all that that they would have to go through. So it's kind of odd now that
I think that was this show, wasn't it? I think that was me. I don't think that was...
Yeah, it was Between the Sheets.
Yeah.
but
close
no,
enough.
I think it was maybe the 91 episode because we were talking about a Pitkin building result.
Yeah, okay. Pitkin building, yeah.
That's right. So that's kind of, I guess, pretty humorous that it was the security team that they employed that then once they got kicked out of the building, they were turning around and saying, you know, oh, it'll be much safer at this other venue.
Well, also, no metal detectors, which could be bad. I mean, atmospherically, it's bad.
Right,
I mean, to have the metal detectors, but maybe...
Might not be the worst measure. Yeah.
Well, 1991 is way different than 2000.
Well, also, yeah, I mean, yeah, you have to think about... Now, metal detectors are standard.
You have to have them.
Yeah, that was...
You have to have them. You have to have them now. But, yeah, back then, it was a different world. But
everything's different. Like, I remember, like... Do you remember how much shit we gave Atlas Security back in the day for the frisking?
Yeah. Now it happens everywhere.
That's pretty standard, too, as well, so
especially at pro sports events and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean it's all changed. I mean it doesn't sound none of this sounds like a big deal anymore.
Exactly. Now regarding the alcohol picks, I mean, do you think that alcohol played a factor in fan violence, or do you think that was all just a big overblown deal just for Lawler to get what he wanted?
Oh, I'm sure it did. I don't see how it couldn't have been a factor. You know, we see this at all kinds of sporting events. I mean, stuff. Usually, it's the people who are drunk who are acting out. So, I'm sure that had a factor. So, I do think he has a legitimate point there.
I'm
total bullshit.
Yeah, it does make some sense, I guess. And speaking of drunks, we go to World Class, where Kevin Von Erich had spent a few days in the hospital.
Actually, you know what? We should probably preface this by explaining how we have World Class in 1990.
Yeah, I was going to build to that.
Okay.
Kevin Von Erich had spent a few days in the hospital after a bleeding ulcer, and they shot an angle on October 19th, the day before this week, where his absence was explained that he had been beaten by John Tatum bloody in the locker room. So he'd beaten John Tatum bloody in the locker room and was removed. And was removed from the building with Tatum coming out after he bladed himself in the locker room to sell the angle. Well, on the October 26th show, Kevin was supposed to be in the main event, teaming with Steve Simpson and Skip Young to face the Angel of Death, John Tatum, and Scandal Ratbar. But Kevin told the crowd that he couldn't wrestle as he hadn't been cleared by his doctors yet, which they never explained why Kevin needed to had gone to the hospital. Well, Steve Collins subbed for him in the main event, and the faces were disqualified because Kevin interfered. This show only drew 160 fans, which is terrible, even with no television. The only advertising they have is through newspaper ads, and Kevin recently buying airtime on KTVT's WWF telecast, which starts out with him saying, "Hi, remember me? I'm Kevin Von Erich." Which is a playoff of the old American Express ads. But yes, World Class is back. This is a short time period, a couple of months maybe, where Jarrett had been kicked out of the sportatorium or just left. By his business partner, Kevin Von Erich. Kevin Von Erich decided to bring back World Class before USW eventually came back at the end of the year or early January. So, yep, there was a World Class reunion tour. And, you know, that all the same names were always around. You know, whether they work in World Class, TWF.
It was a mix of guys from who were already working the Sportatorium for USWA and the guys who were working for Gary Hart.
Yeah, but it's still the Dallas gut crew from
Of course.
The same guys working all the shows.
Now, question, was this from The Observer or was this from Texas Roundup?
This was from The Observer.
Yeah, no. I forgot to put Texas Roundup for it to look over. Did you look? Because I thought it did have a show for this week.
I didn't look at it, no. But yeah, Kevin Montero.
Like an idiot for bringing that up, but whatever.
But, yeah.
I'll pull it up right now. You vamp for a minute with Chad.
But, yeah, Kevin Von Erich was just a complete shell of himself. A lot of these guys were complete shells of themselves in this time period. And I don't know if any of this stuff ever made television.
No, it didn't.
But, Chad, I mean, Dallas had been so hot for years. And then, you know, they basically burned that territory down. And this time period, they're only drawing 160 fans in the Sportatorium. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, kind of becomes... well, I mean, it's sad just with everything surrounding the area, but I mean, the I guess from the world class or the USWA side of things, with the world USWA Texas and the USWA Memphis arm, that produced some interesting dynamics around this time.
Well, Eric Embry, you know, definitely helped bring it back, but. You know, even then, you know, that ran its course.
Right. And you had Changed Man, John Tatum, which I love, and some other things going on. But even with that kind of being fun to go back and revisit, it still was not producing at the box office level locally. So pretty unfortunate. And this I actually didn't know about the World Class Reunion, so that I was as confused as anybody that this had that header. I thought it was kind of just like a holdover, but yeah, with Kevin mixed in and all these other, I guess this is most of your 80s World Class mainstays kind of hanging on to whatever glory they had. But 160 fans, that was awful.
And the television at this time was basically like old tape matches.
You mean the USWA?
Yeah,
right.
Syndication.
Yeah.
You know, Craig Johnson doing, you know, wraparounds, and of course they would show some stuff from Memphis and Louisville, but
well, they did it kind of carefully. What they did was they showed matches from the KTVT show,
yeah,
which had not been seen before, so you could sort of pretend they were new. Do anything,
and of course they would
around them, but they you know, it was Craig Johnson at the studio, and then they did the tapings at it was like three nights back to back that did like 3 months of TV. It was Memphis, Louisville, and Nashville.
Yeah, but then they started back doing fresh shows in Dallas for a little while. Some of them aired on ESPN Classic.
Yeah, at the end of the year, it was they started with the global pilot.
Yeah, and then it aired on ESPN Classic as USWA. That's when you had like a. You know, Eddie Gilbert and Eddie Gilbert, Jeff Jarrett, Tom Pritchard, Embry comes back to steal, that stuff.
Yeah,
that's pre global. Right. Yeah, okay. Which I thought was some fun stuff. But go ahead, Biggs.
All right, so I opened up Texas Roundup for the issue that would cover this weekend. I think we alluded to it once because we didn't really get to use anything from it yet. Texas Roundup was a short-lived newsletter from around this time by an anonymous Dallas area wrestler. Who was backstage at all in the locker room at all these shows? And
but the one thing about the crowd numbers, though, is I noticed that there's a huge difference in between the crowd numbers in that newsletter compared to the other newsletters.
Yeah, he says 365 for this show.
Yeah, and then Meltzer had 160.
Okay, I'm just gonna straight up read what he wrote for the show. Okay,
all right.
The attendance is pretty accurate. I counted. The stories of electricity not being turned on till the last minute were true tonight. Even worse, John Brazil, the office manager, told me they can no longer afford to print the date, seat, and section on the tickets. Each ticket had that information handwritten. Kevin Von Erich came to ringside after the second match to announce that doctors still wouldn't release him to wrestle, but Steve Cox would take his place. There was absolutely no reaction from the crowd. None. Nada. Claiming to have an aggravated stomach ulcer from some bad food he ate in Mexico the week before. I would have thought the vacation...
That food was covered in white powder.
Colorado, considering the substance on his brother Chris's upper lip more resembled snow than sand.
There you go!
typical never-ending ignorance of this family. Basically, I'm disgusted.
That's a glowing review for that show, folks.
So is there any rumors on who was the proprietor of this, though? Or
have we asked anyone? I don't think we either of us read this newsletter before we found it on Jason Campbell's site, right?
Yeah, I have no idea who it could be. So
just to see what else we have. We have a TWF show the next night at the Metroplex Arena, which drew 300.
Yeah, those shows really didn't have nothing going on. They were just matches.
I honestly think Gary Hart has some kind of degenerative brain cell destroying disease. Evidence of the fact was having Terrence Garvin pin Angel of Death clean in the middle, because he would kind of shit on Terry Sims because he was so small and getting pushed.
Yeah, whoever this is.
He's a good worker, though. Yeah.
Yeah, whoever this is did not like Terry Sims.
Although we should ask Terry.
He might know who it is.
I know who it is. Also, with $1,000 per show budget for payroll, he gives 5 matches, at least 1 2-out-of-3 fall match, and no tag teams. For that much money, there should be 7 matches and at least 1 tag match every week. Angel should be ashamed of himself, especially after Garvin played Superman the whole match. It seems you can give him the more he wants. Someone should slap him back to reality, or at least something close. Wow.
You know, that's interesting. You know, I remember reading that before, you know, and getting results from that newsletter, but yeah,
this is great. Hart was pissed that Abdullah the Butcher and Al Perez for juicing too heavy. Yes, that's what I said. Gary didn't want there to be juice on the Halloween show because there was too many kids. How do you book Abby and not expect blood? Wake up, Gary. You knew it was Halloween when you booked him.
Yeah.
I think that's about it. I think for this week at least. If you go to Jason Campbell's, everyone should go to Jason Campbell's site. Go to the text, download the Texas zip file, and it has all of these.
Yeah, and you know,
as you can tell, these are something special. And I was impressed. Did you remember reading that when you were talking about the cocaine joke?
No, I just making the standard Von Erich cocaine joke.
Okay, because that was impressive then.
Yeah, it just fell right into place, didn't it?
I guess so.
But you know, we talk about the unknown wrestler ranting in the Texas Roundup. We'll go to another guy that's known for his ranting in the NWA, the WCW, as Jim Cornette has made the front page of the Altoona Mirror on October 20th after an incident that went down the previous night at the WCW show at the Jaffa Mosque in Altoona, Pennsylvania, where a fan named Mark Williams jumped a railing during a match between the Steiners and the Midnight Express for the United States Tag Titles. And Bobby Eaton got to Williams first, had him down, where Cornette would nail him square in the face with a tennis racket, which busted him open hard way.
Woo! Cornette then,
what?
He makes a point to point. He makes a point to say that the fan was busted open hard way.
I did that.
Oh, that was you. Well, still, yeah. You made a point to say that the fan was busted open.
Well, yeah.
It's a Cornette. Fan. He didn't. What? So the fan.
He hit him that hard.
Okay, but still.
Yeah, I mean, he hit him hard enough to bust him open hard way.
But it's not hard. You get what I'm saying. Never mind.
Yeah, but I use that reference in sports.
Okay.
Okay, if a basketball player gets elbow in the face, I say, oh, he just got busted open hard way.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That's just the way I talk. Cornette then tried to swing again, but Eaton waved him off. The security never kicked Williams out of the building and actually let him return to his ringside seat covered in blood, with a crowd treating him like a hero. And then he went right back to heckling the heels before he was eventually kicked out of the building. Some fans called the police and they questioned the wrestlers before the show was over, as the building was surrounded by police cars and police dogs. Williams' wife told the paper that her husband had been assaulted and it was unprovoked, which Cornette came back quoting, saying that when you jump the railing, you get what you get, in so many words. The newspaper also said that Williams collapsed in the lobby and ended up going to the hospital, but police hadn't decided yet whether they were going to press charges against Cornette or Williams. The only real case against Cornette was probably excessive force, and they were still looking for him as of October 20th because he left the building before further questioning. The police did stop some wrestlers, though, although they were Al Green and Tom Zink. The joke is that Tom Zink, they thought Tom Zink was Jim Cornette. So, but still. What is it with Jim Cornette and fans, Biggs? I mean, and just Jim Cornette and legal issues altogether. You know, we talked about this before.
This may be Associated Press, by the way. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, it was a big deal, but just Jim Cornette's an angry man at times.
Well, I mean, he was being attacked by a fan, though.
Yeah, I mean, in any of his instances, this is probably the most wanted.
Well, also the to some degree the Beckley thing too. The Crockett Beckley thing, not the Smoky Mountain Beckley thing.
Yes.
Was there a Smoky Mountain Beckley thing, or did they just run? Am I thinking of the other thing, the Wise?
Well, you're thinking of the other thing.
I'm thinking Wise Virginia.
Well, no, you're thinking of Beckley because Beckley started up the whole deal with O'Connor.
What are you talking? Wait, no, I'm thinking of his.
That's where he got. No, O'Connor got. We talked about it on the show.
Oh, Casey. Wait.
Yeah, Casey O'Connor. That whole falling out happened in Beckley, West Virginia.
Oh, okay. That's what I was. Yeah. There was a Beckley. A Beckley Smoky Mountain thing. Okay, because the Beckley Crockett thing was the thing he talks about in the book with the big long with the lawsuit that went forever and the. Were a fan, and they were told it was the guy who they ended up hitting through an aisle marker at Eaton or something. I mean, that was from his perspective. I could see why that was justified too, but also I can understand why something like this happens. I mean, as far as other things, there are other things that I could say were over the line. I don't think this one necessarily.
He was well within his boundaries because the fans on the railing and there and everybody's told when that happens you got to handle the business.
Yes, and this one, like I said, Cornette just happened to have
a weapon though.
That's why he started carrying. Well, that was one of the reasons why he started carrying the racket. He thought it was a fun gimmick to be the rich kid, but he also realized he had protection. And what was I saying? And also, he's talked about how if he was like going to the back, like he'd windmill the racket to make sure that fans weren't coming near him, so they just get out of the way. And this one made the Associated Press, who said it was a riot, I believe, right?
Yes.
And I'm trying to remember if there was any other fallout from this. Wasn't there a point where did the Alpha Mosque ever ban wrestling outright, like the Scranton Catholic Youth Center did?
I don't think so.
Because I feel like there's something I'm forgetting.
Well, of course, he was gone from WCW 2 weeks later, but that was for other reasons.
Right, and then, my favorite part, though, is the fan returning covered in blood.
Yes!
Because I think Cornette talked about this in the Midnight Express book, and he's like, the guy looks like a freaking zombie.
Yeah.
Coming back covered in blood and just kind of wandering inside.
What great
security. I
think security
he went back after him, too.
Yeah, what great security work, Chad.
Oh, wait, did he blame Gary Juster for that?
I don't know, but, I mean, it's security.
I feel like there was a
we talk about terrible
Gary
security
Juster
with Memphis.
Let someone back in. I think it was this one.
We talk about terrible security in Memphis. I mean, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Well, the WCW stories with bad security are legion. I mean, those are...
At the mosque, no less.
Yeah, at a mosque, but wow, I mean, this
late.
Is...
I may be using the wrong word all of a sudden.
But man,
yeah, at a mosque. And, I think, like, all the Doug Dillinger stuff, of course, I mean, Bret Hart talking about how his jackets kept getting stolen as soon as he went to WCW.
Yeah, I mean, it's a mess, but yeah, I mean, the security problems, I mean, that's ridiculous. Why do you let a fan back in the seats?
Yeah, even if you think about like the trash that was thrown in the Nitro era, I mean, from a visual standpoint, how I guess visceral that looked and showed like the heat that the NWO was getting. But I mean, fans were just pelting garbage into the wrestlers,
and then fans started running in.
Yeah,
and they started doing plants too instead of trying to discourage it.
Yeah. Fake fan run-ins, fake stings, everything was, yeah.
This ties into that recent WWE stuff, too, although I guess that's calmed down in the last month or so.
Yeah.
Hopefully they made some changes. That was whatever was going on. Cause, well, I mean, one thing at least was the WWE, I guess they'd stopped having any kind of inside-the-rail security, right?
Yeah.
It was all just they had the arena and the WWE security, but... It seemed like it always worked best if they had someone inside the rail, right? Because then, like, if they got past the rail, then it was easier for someone to get to them.
Yeah. Yeah, they've had their problems with it, that's for sure. And going to more legal issues, 26-year-old Arthur Leffler, who works WCW TV tapings as Rick Fargo, was charged with a DUI, running a stop sign, possession of marijuana, and a possible vehicular homicide on October 20th after he ran over and killed a 60-year-old minister visiting from Savannah as he was swerving to miss traffic after he was going home from working his side job as a bouncer for the legendary Gold Rush Strip Club in Atlanta, which Chad had to get that one in.
I'm guessing not to be confused with the Gold's Club.
Oh, there's way – yeah, there's a big difference between Gold Rush and Gold Club. But, yeah, Chad – yeah, the Gold Rush – Gold Rush is off of the former Stewart Avenue, which, you know, that would get referenced a lot on TBS wrestling television by Ric Flair. But it's on the now Metropolitan Avenue, and the Gold Club was in Buckhead, and that's where all your high rollers went. Gold Rush is like your just your normal average strip club, but it's been there forever.
Yeah, I guess it'd be kind of the equivalent of what, like, well, probably not as dingy, but like your Magic City.
Oh, Magic City is like the legend for the urbans and for the blacks.
Right. That's the black spot, but kind of that equivalent of your local friendly strip club.
What was the name of the place?
Yeah, the Cheetah is like is the gold standard.
Right.
For strip clubs in Atlanta. I mean, that's like the major strip club, and that was right beside, well, not right beside, but that was right near Techwood Studios. So, I mean, you know, they just talk about the Cheetah. They have a steakhouse inside the Cheetah called Alluvia. And it was voted the best steakhouse in Atlanta in Creative Loafing Magazine, you know, a few years ago. So, and it's totally separate from the strip club. It's in the same building. But, I mean, there's a part you can sit on one side of the steakhouse and you can see what's going on. But the fact that, yeah, they had at one point the number one steakhouse in Atlanta, which says a lot because there are a lot of steakhouses in Atlanta, a lot of great ones, that they won that award. Yeah, that tells you about that place. But, yeah, the Gold Rush is quite the spot, definitely. But Rick Fargo, if you watch WCW television around this time, and Chad, I know you have, I mean, Rick Fargo is one of those guys that was always around, like a
Bob Cook.
Bob Cook, Tim Parker, those type of guys. The newer versions of the George Souths and stuff like that. But
later on, you had guys like Sonny Trout.
Yeah, Sonny Trout and stuff like that. But he was a local guy. Wasn't very good, of course. But this was an interesting story because it made all the local news. And I was hoping I could find some video of it. There was no way. But 60-year-old minister. That's terrible.
Visiting from Savannah. I'm glad we got that antidote too. And this whole story just seems preposterous because, I mean, Fargo is one of those, like you say, underneath, but like not really, an underneath mainstay with the promotion. You got this minister visiting from Savannah, and the fact that Fargo kills him coming home from his side job working at a strip club. It just kind of, the stars aligned for everything in that story.
Now, I can't remember what happened, Biggs. Do you remember what happened with Fargo? I mean, what was eventually the end was? I don't remember.
I don't recall anything after this, really.
Now, what I was trying to say earlier was when you were talking about the more urban strip clubs. What was the name of the place that Wes took Phil and Tom when they came to Atlanta?
It was one of your very low grade strip clubs. That was near that was off 285, if I'm not mistaken, Chad. It was on like near Stone Mountain area to give you Avondale Estate.
A boomers level or something like that.
Oh, we're lower than that. Maybe like, you know, like the Crazy Horse used to be off of Jonesboro Road. I mean, that was real low grade. Although they Gold Rush now, I think. Well, no, they don't. They Gold Rush, in fact, bought out the Crazy Horse and has now reopened it as a newer strip club. So
Now what? to get in all of our Atlanta strip club geography. So what went in where the Pink Pony was on the south side in Jonesboro?
That's where the new Crazy Horse is.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's it. Okay, there we go. So we've come full circle.
Yeah, the deal with the Pink Pony and on the south side is that the Clayton County Board of Commissioners, you sent the edict down that you either had to be fully nude with no alcohol. Yeah, right. Or topless and alcohol.
And alcohol, yeah.
And the Pink Pony bosses were like, fuck that shit, and just close the doors. And, of course, that was the second one. They had their main one up there off of, Peachtree Dunwoody?
Mm-hmm. It's Peachtree Dunwoody. It's up in Alpharetta.
For those of you that don't know, the Atlanta strip club is like maybe number two in the nation as far as strip club. I think Houston's number one.
Are we talking about quantity?
No, I'm talking about like just all together. I read some report that Atlanta was number two by
strip club city.
Tampa's got to be high up.
Yeah, I was shocked that it was that high. And I thought Houston being number one was weird. Yeah. But Houston, Atlanta, New Orleans, Tampa are like your top four. But yeah, Atlanta is definitely known for their strip clubs, no doubt.
And if my wife ever listens to the show for some reason, this is all stuff I've heard.
This is all alleged.
Alleged, yes.
But
what I've read in the AJC.
That's the one thing, Bix, that I wish that we could get is the old localized promos for the Omni that used to air on TBS, where all this stuff would be mentioned in promos by like the Horsemen and shit like that. Flair used to always love mentioning, Stewart Avenue, the Cheetah, all the arm would do it, all the local hotspots. On the air, in those promos. And we don't have the localized tapes. I know you have a little.
I had very little.
Yeah. But, that used to air on local TBS, to promote the Omni shows.
Did I ever tell you what the story with behind that tape was?
I don't remember it. I remember you told me something, but I don't remember.
I'm trying to remember what the name of the guy was. It was a guy who sent I think he did jobs on the TV briefly, and that's what. And he sent that tape to Bill Watts to try to get booked.
Yeah, because it had All South on there too,
and I think he was on that too, right?
The 85.
Whoever the guy was, South. it was like it made me the name. Whoever what was the guy's name? It made me think of that guy. You know the story Cornette always tells of the job guy who wanted to try to get all his shit in against the Midnights.
Yeah.
It was a name like that, but it wasn't that guy. It wasn't like what was that guy's name? Like Willie Wilkins or something. It was something like that.
Yeah.
It wasn't that guy. But that's what it was. He was like, he sent this tape with him. That was just, it wasn't just his matches. It was the tape that had his matches getting squashed to Bill Watts to try to get booked.
Yeah. All South in that tape, Chad, I think some of it was taped in Carrollton.
Interesting. Yeah,
at the fairgrounds, and I think some of us have been in high school.
And we've never seen any of that other.
No, that was all the
five All South stuff either.
Yeah.
So what year time frame are 85. We?
This is right after Crockett bought out the TBS time slot, and Ann Gunkel had brought back her All South again.
Right.
And it aired on Channel 46.
Okay. So,
but Channel 46 was still an independent station.
It wasn't the CBS affiliate at that.
Yeah,
time.
No, it was still independent. Yeah.
And your top stars were Tommy Rich as the top babyface, and your top heels were the team of Randy Rose and Doug Summers as the other Rose and Summers.
Yeah.
Nice.
And Mr. Olympia was around wrestling too.
A little bit, yeah. Too, but that not on the stuff I think we had. But
well, I know. I mean, Summers is he still locally lives like 10 minutes from where I live. He's around here. He lives over in Temple. So,
yeah, they ran that loop of Carrollton. They ran Griffin. They ran Jackson. They ran shows here in Barnesville. Yeah, it was a short-lived promotion. In fact, they were trying to hook up with Jarrett. And
well,
there's
they kind of did.
Yeah, there's a show that's a mixture of All South and Memphis. It's got Freddie Miller and Lance Russell as the announcers.
Interesting.
Because they had Freddie Miller, because this was after Freddie Miller got fired, I guess, by WWF.
Yeah.
And it's TV taping from, was it May 85, I think?
Yeah, and it was a pilot for ESPN.
Right, this is where they, because it was when ESPN was soliciting wrestling shows, they shot the pilot, they got a new ring, they changed the lighting a little bit, and it was, well, there were a few different, like, they experimented with a few different announcers. It was, like, one was Lance and Freddie Miller, then there was also one with Lance, like, Lance Luthez and Ann Gunkel.
Yeah.
Something like that, and, right, because it was the Tommy Rich beating, who was it, Moondog Rex?
Moondog Rex.
With the Thez Press, yeah, at the run of Luthez.
Yeah, and this is right before Moondog Rex went to Mid-South. So yeah, I mean, yeah, I know we're way out of, off topic here, but yeah, I just love talking. I love talking about the local stuff.
Yeah, this has been a wild show.
Yeah. Now our final story. I didn't want to end on the Rick Fargo story. We're going a lot of order. Our final story is we have Lex Luger taping an appearance for the syndicated TV series Superboy on October 23rd, which will air during the first week of November. Now, supposedly Luger is going to play a Norse god trying to help Superboy out of a jam. Now, meanwhile, we have Paul E. Dangerously taping an appearance on Sally Jesse Raphael, which is funny this week since Renee Young was called Sally Jesse Raphael on Raw, on October 18th, which will air on October 30th. The story was that one of her guests, Ernie Lannerman, had a fantasy to be a wrestling manager, so Paul came out, surprised him, and then gave him tips on how to be a manager. But, Bix, you were telling me that Luger did not play a Norse god on the show.
Okay. I don't remember if I saw this when it aired, but from what's on YouTube, it's that on YouTube there's just this dream sequence, and maybe what happens is that he's the Norse god, and then Superboy's worried he's going to get upstaged or something, because it's a dream sequence where Luger is in the Superman/Superboy outfit, and everyone's talking about, oh my god, it's the new Superboy. It's very weird. It's like even though it's a dream sequence, it's like I think it's still on YouTube. So, but I think there's something with him being a robot in that too. So that's why I was thinking it wasn't the Norse god, because I thought there was something with him being a robot too.
Well, the other way people made Luger being a robot jokes anyway in wrestling, but Luger I think changed his hair around this time period too a little bit. I guess this is probably for this role. Because I don't know if it was around this time period that he changed the, like it was a different type of curling going on in the back or something like that. He had a different hairstyle. Around Havoc.
I think he has the big flowing Luger hair in that.
Okay, well maybe.
Yeah, it's straight on. I'm watching it now. It's the straight on top, but it's back. But the way it's combed is a little different, where it's kind of curly. This is an odd clip.
It is, isn't it?
I mean, him in the Superman outfit punching Superboy, and I don't know.
People don't remember this show. I mean, this Superboy show went a few years. It was syndicated, and it went a few years. Yeah. During the time period when superheroes was not nearly as big as it is now. Nowhere close.
And this is sort of the tail end of first-run syndication being a thing, too.
Yes.
Because I want to say, like, by a few years after this, you really did not have first-run comedies and dramas in syndication anymore.
Yeah, it would, you know, then would get restarted in the mid-90s. You know, I remember different things going on. Like, what was the one that Bandit was on?
What? I don't know.
They did a TV show based off Smokey and the Bandit.
Oh, I don't
know. And it was part of the series The Hercules. The Kevin Sorbo show.
Oh, yeah. Well, when I say, I mean, yeah,
there was like William Shatner. Tech War was on that.
Tech War was USA.
No, there was a William Shatner science fiction show that's part of that. I think it's called Action Pack or something.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, you're right. We did still have Baywatch Nights even, and Hercules
Action Pack. Yeah, in 94, you had the Action Pack. You had Hercules. You had Tech War. You had the Bandit. You had Banishing Sun. And you had a spinoff of Midnight Run. These went from 1994 to 1996. And, of course, Xena spun off of there with Hercules. Hercules and Xena were easily the most successful of the shows on there.
Right.
But yeah.
Generally, you didn't really have that many besides Hercules, Xena, Baywatch.
Yeah, it was Universal syndicated it out. And I remember that being a big deal at the time.
Although for comedies, though, it had died. Like, I'm trying to think what else. Like, comedy was dead. I guess, but this is sort of a kid's show, Superboy, but not exactly. Like, was it? I mean, it was targeted towards kids, wasn't it?
Yes.
And then, but I'm trying to think what else were there back then, because I think, like, what would be, like, other famous examples of first-run syndication? Small Wonder was first-run syndication.
Yes.
Trying to think what else. There were shows that came off networks and did first-run syndication. Well, Baywatch. Baywatch was a network show originally.
Yeah, on NBC. Yeah.
This is, I guess, I'm trying to think, like, because WCW very rarely got stuff like this.
Yeah, it's a pretty big deal.
How big a deal do we consider this?
That was a big deal. I don't even know if they ever advertised it on WCW television.
Oh, of course.
I mean, I don't recall it if they did. So,
I mean, that's just the way they are. So, anyway, the Paul E. Sally Jesse Raphael clip, I remember seeing it, you know, years ago. I haven't seen it since, but Paul was full on Paul, fully hammy Paul Heyman. And in this role, he thought he was having the time of his life. So I don't even know if that's on YouTube or not, but I remember
being pretty. That, no.
I remember being pretty funny. But on that note, we had a good show. Went long, really good show. Went longer than I thought. So we still having our marathon shows, but not nearly as long. But still, considering that we only had you know, not a few pages of notes compared to some of these other mega notes we've had. It still went a pretty good distance. So props to us for being long-winded. But anyway, Chad, what you got going on the Place to Be Nation Network?
I got three things I'll plug here. One is Where the Big Boys Play. Our next episode will be Beach Blast 92. I'm probably going to try to record that in the next couple of weeks. So you can check that out if you're so inclined. And then I actually want to plug two things that are coming up for 2016. One that's going to be on Pro Wrestling Only, and that is Wrestling 365, which we kind of did, I guess, a pilot week for. But that's something Charles Lost, the admin over there, has been kind of generating, and I've been helping a little bit compiling and stuff. It's a concept I really like, because now with the footage, the wrestling footage we have so readily available, I like watching stuff that I feel like I'm kind of having a purpose, so to speak, but there's so much stuff out there that a lot of times I'll just kind of sit in a YouTube gaze and kind of not know what to watch or what to look at if I have a spare 10, 15 minutes. So with Wrestling 365, we're hoping that, you know, we'll kind of post the signature matches that happened on that day. You can watch them, comment on them. And the beauty about this project in my eyes is that it's evergreen. And, you know, if you miss a day, if you're busy or whatever, then just skip it and go to the next one. You can kind of catch it the next year. So that's one thing. And then the second thing coming out in 2016 is, Chris, you've talked about on Pro Wrestling Only, you've been doing your indie reviews. Going back and looking at some of the 2001 stuff, and that inspired me. So I accumulated a whole big batch of IWA Mid-South, and I have started going through those shows starting in 2001, and those reviews will be posted on Place to Be Nation in the first year. I've kind of entitled the article overall as The Last Territory, and hoping to go through the promotion chronologically from 2001 up to, 2006, 2007 throughout the indie boom. So I'm really looking forward to that. In the first couple of shows I've watched, there's a lot of, just great stuff, profanity laced, promos, people getting pissed in the crowd and getting them shoving matchups, Tracy Smothers doing his thing. So a lot of highlights early on there.
Yeah, awesome. And yeah,
hopefully
I'll have a new one of those indie shows up this week. I mean, well, next week on the Pro Wrestling Only. But Bix, I know you have a lot to plug, so get them out.
I don't know. What? Follow me on Twitter at David Bix. I guess the big thing to plug for this week is that the new Fighting Spirit comes out on, technically Thursday. Usually the download comes out at midnight British time on Thursday, so usually about 7 o'clock Eastern on Wednesday, 7 p.m., that is, got a nice article about Eddie Guerrero, you know, 10-year anniversary of his passing, unfortunately, and talked to Tom Pritchard, talked to Scott Norton, talked to Jim Ross, got some good stuff. I really liked how it came out, so that's in there, and of course, you know, got stuff, you know, most days on SE Scoops and MMA News, and also, you know, daily up, you know, and some of the daily updates on WrestlingObserver.com and Figure Four Weekly, usually Mondays. This we just a couple of things we did to get in sync this week. It, assuming everything goes right, hoping that I'll have my review copy of WWE 2K16 and we'll have the review. Although, because of the embargo and stuff, that would probably not be up till at least midnight Monday night or early Tuesday, depending on when. What the embargo letter says.
Interesting.
Oh, yeah, that's one of those video game things. You don't know about that?
Yes, I know all about the video game things.
The embargo letter. Yeah, that's a
whole
thing for people who don't know about it. I mean, I guess it's pretty well known now, I think. But
I know about that from about the Madden, you know, stuff with Madden and other.
You're not actually signing anything, though. Although, when I went to the media event, though, I did have to sign an NDA. That I wouldn't talk about the games stuff I played in the game till Monday, but they don't actually, like, legally you're not bound to anything when you get the review copy. But you know, obviously if they cut you off if you don't hold to it.
Exactly. Well, on to my plugs. For of course, follow me on Twitter at KRISCELLNER, and for all my Twitter banter. And we got a new Exile on Bad Street that, let's see, this show goes up on Monday. So today, this show is up on the 26th. Hopefully, Exile is up by now. I'm not going to make any guarantees, but it's a really good show featuring Rob Bahari and Joe Lanza. Yeah, that's right, Joe Lanza, making his first time appearance on one of my shows. And we're talking about The Art of the Wrestling Crowds.
Oh, really? And,
yes. And on the next Between the Sheets, we will definitely have Bix's rebuttal to some comments made on the show. So, little tease coming that, yes. There.
Yeah, so are these comments about me, or are these just comments in opposition of something I've said?
It's not about you in general, but it's about a stance you took recently.
Well, Joe did talk about it on Voices of Wrestling, though, so I probably heard the gist of his.
Yeah, you basically know what it's going to be. But we're going to let you respond, have a chance to respond on the next Between the Sheets, so be on the lookout for that. Anyway, but that show's a really good show. Of course, the next Between the Sheets will be a week from today. We will talk about sometimes next day or two about which week we're going to do. And yeah, definitely. You know, as Chad said, they rewatching the indies deal. I always try to post that link up on Twitter for whenever I watch a new show. So definitely on the lookout for that. And you know, he's also mentioned Pro Wrestling Only and stuff going on there. The Greatest Wrestler Ever project's going on. We've had some hot and heated debates on there lately, and it's a great project. I think everybody that can get involved should get involved in. Because, I mean, you know, whether you like Ric Flair, you like Jerry Lawler, you like El Dandy, Manami Toyota, Yuki Ishikawa, Daisuke Ikeda, Super Porky, whatever you like, Jim Breaks, you know, whatever style of former wrestling you like, put a ballot of 100 down. It shouldn't be that hard. And send it in. You know, the more the better, you know. These lists always end up with pretty much the same guys hanging around the top. But, you know, that variety, man, it always helps out. And I always like to see what other people got to say.
Well,
so,
this Marcus Joyce one from 10 years ago ended up having a pretty good amount of variety. So,
yeah. That's
what we're striving for.
And that's what this project's, you know, the 10-year anniversary of that. So, it ends at WrestleMania. So, I mean, shit, you got, 5 months left to watch stuff. So. You're trying to get involved, all you people that are listening, that aren't so inclined. And I think that's pretty much about it.
I remembered one thing. I don't know okay. if any of us will be part of it, but remember to download the reaction show.
That's right, reaction show.
Hell in a Cell.
You probably downloaded it.
But. Hell in a Cell reaction show out today. So be on the lookout for that. I know I'll be on there. So I don't know if anybody else, but yeah, it should be an interesting show to say the least. But on that note, I'd like to thank Chad for being on the show for the first time. Definitely have him back. And I think there's a big enough difference in the way we talk. People won't get that confused. So,
people don't know how to parse Southern accents.
Yeah, he's got that West Georgia accent. I got that Middle Georgia accent.
You really big, don't sound big that difference. Similar at all.
I don't think so either, but
yeah, I know. I just heard that.
Yeah, I've heard that same claim. But so
all you Southerners sound alike. Yeah, I know.
I mean, now Johnny Sorrow and Hugh sound kind of alike. I feel like.
Yeah, in a way.
And you little, but actually, I feel like Hugh kind of sounds like the love child of Johnny Sorrow and my friend Matt Roth. Former MMA writer who did an MMA podcast and stuff. If anyone who knows him will laugh at that if they who's heard both. But yeah, so
yeah, Johnny Sorrow's got a distinctive voice, and Hugh does too. So, but that, again, we're way off topic.
And I think anyway, I stopped talking directly into the mic again.
So. Yeah, you did. You did it again. You need to talk in a tip. Get your mouth on that tip. You know, you should know about that. But anyway, we'll be back for next week's show, and for Chad and for Vix. This is Chris saying so long. From the Peach State of Georgia.